What a piece of luck. We start our election campaign today.
Elections? In this place?
Of course, we make our choice every 12 months. Every citizen has a choice. Are you going to run?
Like blazes, the first chance I get.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday the 11th of November 2022, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from the Apple and all good app stores, not necessarily Google. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda. And continued suppression of COVID jab injuries. Navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. LBC journalist in part one this week, arrested for covering the Extinction Rebellion protests from a bridge over the motorway. I have just one word to say about all that, and that is the word bitumen. So how are we going to get all these roads to run these electric cars on without bitumen? And David Icke is banned from Europe. Well, this happened last week, but I think it would be interesting to hear a clip from him and just to prove that, I actually say and write quite a lot about how dodgy Icke is, but obviously this is an interesting phenomenon in being banned from Europe. It's just appalling. But maybe there's a purpose behind all this. Also, the BBC pillory Richard D. Hall, who's a so-called conspiracy researcher that some people take very seriously. In part two, former Pacifica radio journalist Don DeBar, we have him on the horror story, that is the US midterm elections and elections generally in the United States. He's interesting. He's a communist who's got a certain amount of Donald Trump sympathies, and I didn't even know such things existed. Then also we've got an unidentified Australian lady, very good I think she is, talking about a potential trap the World Economic Forum are trying to lure us into. And New Zealand, looking at New Zealand a bit this week, as I promised last time, dairy farmer Steve Branston I spoke to a couple of days ago. He's a spokesman for Groundswell, which is the or one of the big New Zealand farming advocacy organisations, where as they're trying to bring in this zero carbon policy here. I nearly said zero COVID, but I mean, because they had that too, obviously, but the zero carbon policy, which will make a big dent in New Zealand exports. A lady called Joan Brooks talking about New Zealand's life and politics. And finally, legendary New Zealand preacher Barry Smith, three evil figures he talks about at the end of the world from the Book of Revelation. Martin, anything you'd like to talk about this week?
If it's going to be a New Zealand programme, I don't know whether we should be talking about British and Bristol politics. It's up to you, isn't it, really?
Why not? No, look, it's not a New Zealand programme. Quite a lot of the stories I just gave you there were not New Zealand stories. But anyway, David Icke, as far as I know, is not...
No. He's not the mainstream, it's not PMQs, is it?
Well, we've got a bit of that too.
Okay, well, if that's all that on the menu, then we can take it from there, can't we?
Okay, so nothing particularly. But anyway, Martin, I'm sure you will have plenty to say, particularly in part two. About what wider conflicts around the world. I've also got some info about something called inclusive capitalism, which I'd love to hear your take on that, Martin. Certainly won't start with that, but it's an organisation set up by Lady Lynn Forrester de Rothschild and Prince Charles when he was Prince Charles, now obviously King Charles.
I think the Pope's got something to do with it as well.
He has, yes. In fact, well done. Lady Lynn Forrester has managed to recruit the Pope. Is it possible to have inclusive capitalism, that the super rich can, including royalty and the aristocracy of Europe, can include everybody in their little capitalist world, Martin?
Well, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. And because people all around the world can see that capitalism just don't work, the capitalists are now coming up with a capitalism light, inclusive capitalism, kind capitalism. And that's because they're trying to defend the existence of capitalism, which, of course, is very much moot as we speak, since the whole financial system is totally dependent on government subvention. Otherwise, it wouldn't exist. So there isn't any capitalism. That's why they're talking about it.
Yeah, I think we've discussed this many times, haven't we? 2008, capitalism actually died.
Yes, effectively. Once you decide you're going to bail out the private banking system, then the textbook goes out of the window and we're not in Kansas anymore. And we haven't been for a long time.
No. Anyway, let's go straight to Prime Minister's questions then, since you brought that up, and have a listen to Keir Starmer, who is... Well, I mean, there was all this stuff this week. Maybe you can fill me in. I haven't actually figured out what it's about, really. But apparently some MP was a bully and he's had to resign.
That's Gavin, Gavin Williamson, who used to be the head of the Whip's office. And if you remember, he had a photograph of himself with a tarantula, a pet tarantula, and a whip on his desk. And... he's been accused by Tory MPs, because, of course, he used to be the Tory whip, and also top civil servants, of just being a bully. And these things were already in the pipeline when Rishi Sunak decided that he was going to bring him back. He's been sacked several times from the cabinet. He was going to bring him back, but he's had to go. So, of course, it really reflects on Rishi, what do you think you're doing? I mean, he'd already got all this hanging over him. Why did you bring him into the cabinet?
Are they going to be bringing Priti Patel back too?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what it shows is that, I think what it really shows underlying all of this is that Sunak has had to put various people in the cabinet in order to become prime minister, who he probably wouldn't have chosen, but he's been forced to take them in order to kind of keep his own side united. But of course, they're damaged goods and they've got all this baggage, and therefore he's had to chuck them overboard. So, it's the ongoing shambles, really.
I take a different tack on that. I think that some of these individuals are easily pliable, that the intelligence services have got dirt on them, and so they're the people that the deep state wants to have in these key positions. And when they get bounced out, just like Peter Mandelson, for example, had to resign, that their temptation is that they want to put them back in again because they're so easy to manipulate.
Well, that's true. I mean, Gavin Williamson, I mean, I wouldn't say he probably, he was a Minister of Defence, I think, at one stage, so he probably has got contacts with the intelligence services. But I think the thing is that they want to control these people, but the real narrative underlying this is that Sunak's cabinet is already falling apart. You know, it's almost, and I don't know if you saw today, you probably didn't, that Kwasi Kwarteng was defending his mini budget, which trashed the economy, and saying it was all Liz Truss's fault and he just signed off on her ideas, and that he didn't want to do any of that anyway, and he's trying to rehabilitate himself, even though he's just managed to crash the economy and tank the pound. But there you are.
Well, I know. I do think that it doesn't seem as if it's possible for anybody really to get into the cabinet. There may be some MPs out there who have a mind of their own, but they will certainly get nowhere near power. I mean, obviously, it's quite obvious with somebody like Gavin Williamson, first of all, that he's a nerd. I mean, you know, that's the way I can describe him. He's somebody that doesn't really seem to really think for himself. He made that ridiculous comment about Putin, wasn't it? I wish he'd go away.
Yes, they should. The Russians should just shut up and go away.
That's it. Yeah.
To Mars.
Well, I mean, you know,
Venus. Anywhere.
He's just a useful idiot. But anyhow, so let's have a listen to PMQs with a couple of. I think we actually get two questions in here in the clip this week to get a little bit more of a feel. From Starmer to Rishi Sunak, the new-ish Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the problem is he can't stand up to a run-of-the-mill bully. Yeah. So he has no chance of standing up to vested interests on behalf of working people. Yeah. Take Shell. They made record profits this year, £26 billion. How much have they paid under his so-called windfall tax?
Mr. Speaker, I was Chancellor who introduced an extra tax on the oil and gas companies. Right, but he talks, Mr. Speaker, he talks about working people. The Right Honourable Member voted against legislation to stop strikes disrupting working people. He voted against legislation to stop extremist protesters disrupting working people. That's because he's not on the side of working people, Mr. Speaker. That's what the Conservatives are for.
Mr. Speaker, I'm against all of those causing chaos, damage to our public services and to our economy, whether they are gluing themselves to the road or sitting on the government benches. Mr. Speaker, there was no answer to the question because the answer is nothing. Shell haven't paid a penny in windfall tax. Why? Because for every pound they spend digging for fossil fuels, he hands them a 90p tax break, and it's costing the taxpayer billions. So will he find a backbone and end his absurd oil and gas giveaway?
Well, Mr. Speaker, what the party opposite will never understand is that it's businesses investing that create jobs in this country. Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House, we understand that. We will support businesses to invest, to create jobs, because that's how we create prosperity, that's how we support strong public services, and that's what you get with a Conservative government.
Well, he's arguing that he's creating jobs. I'm not quite sure how, Martin, the idea of massive bailouts for the energy company creates jobs.
Well, it's not so much a bailout, is it? I mean, they are making super profits because of the international situation. Well, no. It's funny that that Starmer referred to the measures that have been taken as a windfall tax, because Rishi Sunak, when he was the Chancellor, was very keen for it to be called a supplementary levy or something of that sort, so they didn't have to use the horrid words windfall tax. And of course, it's a sore point, because it's an obvious thing to do across the political spectrum, and certainly out there in the country. People can see if the oil and gas companies are making profits. Nothing has changed in their operating procedures. They've just managed to corner a very tight market.
Surely it's pretty obvious what's going on. The oil and gas companies are in bed with the banks. And they are just basically kicking the government around and telling them what to do. And, you know, they're saying, well, actually now we want society to be, rather than to be a government that's working for the benefit of society and in democracy, we just want the people to be a cash cow for us. And we want you to use your ability to create and levy taxes and collect taxes to funnel money into energy companies' shareholders.
Well, that's true, because of course by capping the energy price and subsidising it, they're giving free money to the energy companies. And of course these companies in civilised parts of the world, Russia, Norway, are owned by the government. So that all the billions of extra profit they're making because of the international situation, that becomes available to plug the holes in the government's finances. But because of Britain being run as it has been, in the way it has for the last 40 years, when this happens, the shareholders get a massive kickback. And also, of course, the other thing that they're able to do is they can buy back their own shares, which used to be illegal. It was regarded as manipulation. It was illegal. You could go to prison for doing it. But now all of these major companies do it, buy back their own shares with profits that they've made, which pushes the share price up, which gives the shareholders an extra boost. And of course, the managers get most of their remuneration through shares rather than being paid a salary. And of course, that's not the way to run these things. A nationalised company would have somebody in charge with a pretty good salary if they were any good, and that's all they get. That's it.
One of the other. So, because we're discussing this, we should skip on to have a look at this whole thing about inclusive capitalism, particularly now the boss of inclusive capitalism is also the king. So it's nice to have a king that wants everybody to have all the money rather than just a few people. I mean, that's great, isn't it? So can we have a listen now? Let's have a listen to His Royal Highness, as he was back in 2015 at their big conference, where they got all these Bilderbergers and bigwigs together, to the Prince of Wales, obviously now King Charles, to give us an idea of what he means by inclusive capitalism. And we hear what Martin has to say. And this, as I say, is from 2015, this clip.
Many of you here today are pioneers, I know, in this process. And you have shown that this commitment does not have to incur a financial cost. Indeed, as my accounting for sustainability project has demonstrated only too clearly, it is only by adopting a broader sense of value that our finances will be sustained and we can find new sources of profit. Well, if there is a price to pay for achieving the necessary transformation, it will be our abandoning of the next seemingly easy short-term solution that our current form of capitalism thinks is necessary, and instead focusing on approaches that achieve lasting and meaningful returns. This, for instance, would involve paying due attention to both social and environmental capital. It would involve putting young people properly at the heart of companies' employment practices and planning strategies in order to tackle more effectively the world's growing youth unemployment crisis. It would also go some way to helping those who are most vulnerable in our societies. After all, it is perhaps worth bearing in mind that at the end of the day, the primary purpose of capitalism should surely be to serve the wider long-term interests and concerns of humanity rather than the other way round. So critically, it would require the incorporation of environmental externalities. We would have to account properly for carbon dioxide emissions, the use of water and fertilizer, the pollution we produce, and the biodiversity we lose. All of these would have to be comprehensively considered in our economic and national decision-making, because inclusive capitalism cannot be truly inclusive if our dependence on natural capital, what Pavan Sukhdev astutely describes, I think, as the economic invisibility of nature, is not also included in our calculation of value and economic worth. Ladies and gentlemen, we stand at a pivotal moment in history. Either we continue along the path we seem collectively determined to follow, apparently at the mercy of those who so vociferously and aggressively deny that our current operating model has any effect upon dangerously accelerating climate change, which I fear will bring us to our own destruction, or we could choose to act now before it is finally too late, using all of the power and influence that each of you can bring to bear to create an inclusive, sustainable, and resilient society. There will, of course, be hard choices to make. And take it from me, in the short term, you will not be popular with your peers. But if you stand firm and take the kind of action that is needed, I have every confidence the rewards will be immense.
Well, King Charles there speaking 7 years ago at this inclusive capitalism conference. There's so much in that, Martin, but I want to just give us your immediate reaction.
Well, I mean, these kind of views coming from King Charles, Prince as he then was, are, you know, relatively well known. And what I feel like saying is, where's the economic analysis? I mean, he wants to be on the right side of what you might call bien pensant opinion, you know, being thought, you know, capitalism is...
He's got a plan. He's got a plan.
No, he hasn't got a plan. Somebody else has got one. He's just fronting for it.
Havan Sukhdev, whoever that is.
Well, exactly. So, in other words, that's been spatchcocked in there so that it doesn't just sound like him pontificating.
So what he's talking really is about, things like, he's being fairly specific there, saying that, he's talking about this whole zero carbon thing, really, where he's saying, oh, look, fertilizer, this isn't factored in, all the terrible effects on the environment of fertilizer. He was also saying there, he's talking about the climate being destroyed. Well, I mean, I don't see that personally. I mean, he's also using this word, I feel the climate will be destroyed. Look, I mean, where's the evidence for the climate being destroyed? Well, I mean, obviously, pollution does harm the environment, but is the climate being... I mean, how can the climate being destroyed? Anyway, hard choices as well, he says, for the super rich.
Well, look, I mean, think about what this organisation is. It's a gathering of the super rich and powerful to pat each other on the back about how kind they're going to be to the environment and to the poor. And, you know, where are the trade union leaders? Where's Lula? Is he at this meeting? No. I mean, around the world, people are questioning whether capitalism is the model to follow. Now, actually, we're getting into a very deep question here about what does it mean to be anti-capitalist? Greta Thunberg was saying we're going to have to get rid of capitalism. So she's taking a more radical view, not inclusive capitalism, no capitalism. But what I would say as an economist is people talking about inclusive capitalism or no capitalism, it's just not specific enough. What are we talking about here? A nationalized banking system like in China? Nationalized industries like in Russia? What are we talking about?
It seems to me that there's, because of this absolute obsession with economic growth and the idea that everything has to be taxed and there has to be a financial, number on everything. I mean, this is one of the reasons that women, for example, were persuaded to go out to work as well as men. You got two people working in the house because women were doing free work, looking after the house, looking after the kids. There's an absolute obsession about more and more things being monetized. I mean, that seems to me what's really driving this. You go to many developing countries and you'll find that people are growing quite large parts of their own food. They're not paying any money for rent to somebody else. They've got a piece of land of their own that they've got a shack on or whatever. And that seems to me to be a better solution. That is to try to extract money from the equation, so people are not having to pay vast sums for their rent or for their food or for their energy. That is actually a better solution, because to actually reduce people's dependence on money, surely.
Well, in some parts of the third world, you do have widespread land ownership by relatively poor people, only where land reform has been carried out. And, of course, in other parts of the world, the poor have been pushed off the land by big landowners, many of whom, of course, are enthralled to the major companies that are all in the inclusive capitalism racket.
I mean, even in somewhere like France, Martin, you've got a large peasant population.
Well, that came about because of the French Revolution and the redistribution of the land. And we didn't do that here in Britain.
So no, we certainly did.
So that's a big difference between Britain and France in terms of mental attitudes and all sorts of other things.
I suppose he's talking about a pivotal moment in history. It's almost like he's kind of preempting this whole idea of the Great Reset there. Let's have a Great Reset. As you say, Greta Thunberg is saying we need a non-capitalist reset. He's saying we want an inclusive capitalist reset. I suppose what I'm saying is we just need to guarantee people these basic essentials of life, water, food, shelter, and then the whole of society will become far less dependent on money. And I suppose the super rich, that's going to be a bit of a hard sell if Prince Charles or King Charles wants to sell that to them.
Well, one of the things that makes me most worried about what this inclusive capitalism agenda entails is it is the monetization of nature. Nature hasn't been monetized, and capitalism tends to you exploit resources because they're free. Yeah. Air's free, so you just take it. forests today, you just chop them down. Now, what they're talking about...
Are you sure?
Yeah, what they're talking... In the Amazon, the people have been going for...
Martin, surely we should be charging people for breathing, shouldn't we?
All right, well, if you want to make sarcastic remarks, you may.
But well, course, I know, this is where it's heading, isn't it?
This is where it's going. I mean, on the Tokyo Underground, for example, there are, oxygen pay points where you put money in and you can have a blast of oxygen. Capitalism tries to monetize everything. And I totally accept that we shouldn't be... One of the problems with this inclusive capitalism, environmental capitalism, is they want to monetize nature so that they can then trade nature and say, we may be cutting this forest down here, but we've built another forest over here and we've got a carbon trading system that allows us to do all of this. This is what's underlying all of this, is they're trying to turn it all into monetary things, and that's supposedly a solution so that the market can then work to allocate resources. What you need to do is you need to put some things outside the market. Yeah. Say, we're not going to have that. We're not going to put this in the market at all. I mean, and there's amazingly a whole section of things that we're not going to marketize.
Over here in New Zealand, and we may be hearing a little bit more about this in part two, there is this thing called Three Waters they're doing, which, I mean, the most of the rural population are up in arms about this. It's something which, obviously, anybody that's on the water mains grid going to be less affected, because what they're trying to do, and it's caused all sorts of ructions here, is to bring people's septic tanks, the natural rainwater roof collection tanks. A lot of people use the water that falls on their roofs, and that is used in the home. And they have boreholes, as of course people do in the UK. What Jacinda and the Labour government here are trying to do, and it seems to be completely the opposite of what... King Charles is talking about there, this whole idea of, maybe it's similar. He's saying that money should serve us rather than we serve money. But, I mean, he's saying that here in New Zealand, what they're saying with the Three Waters program is all that will suddenly become government-owned, all the infrastructure that you've put into, and of course it's a largely rural society here, this will all become owned by the government, and the government will own the borehole that you put in there 50 years ago or whatever, and will own all of basically the rain that falls on your roof and goes into your tank, and it will also own all the infrastructure that you've put in there. So this is really a massive grab of people's, it's what people need to live, and of course it doesn't cost them a penny once they've put that in there, and it doesn't cost them anything. I think they have to pay a very small amount for the boreholes a year, say something like $40. I was hearing from one of the farmers, it's something like $100 a year or something that they have to pay. But they're now trying to renegotiate all these contracts. So it seems to me there's a far greater, what they're doing is a far greater dependence on money. I mean, you couldn't make it up. There he is saying, well, we want money to serve us. And then what they're doing is they're forcing people to be more and more dependent on money all the time. Anyway, look, we'll have a listen now then to, you mentioned the Pope, didn't you, Martin? You don't always bring him up.
Well, I know. I just happen to know that he's involved in this inclusive capitalism.
He is, isn't he? And who is it that has managed to bring the Pope on board? Well, none other than the wife of Evelyn de Rothschild, who sadly died this week, Lynn Forrester. So let's hear from her now, back in 2015 again, one of the founders of this Council for Inclusive Capitalism.
What did you do to get the Vatican on board?
Well, the Vatican has asked for concrete actions to benefit all people. And in his encyclical in 2020, the Fratelli Tutti, he talked about reconciling the world of finance and the world of work. And that is what we are doing. Pope Francis doesn't point an accusatory finger at wealth creation and capitalism. But what he wants is for the creation of wealth to aid and not destroy the planet and the people on it. So we are responding to his call to reform capitalism, to make it inclusive, to make it sustainable, to make it trusted as well as dynamic.
Yes, it seems to be using these little, all these various words, trusted, sustainable, dynamic capitalism, Martin.
Yeah, well, as we said earlier, capitalism basically died in 2008. It just died. It's a dead donkey. So all of these people going on about how we must reform capitalism, what they mean is we have to preserve capitalism, and this is our plan. I mean, can't people see what's wrong with getting all of the wealthiest capitalists together and saying, hey, we've got to change the system for the better? I mean, in the past, there was a more robust attitude towards these kind of people. The Pope and the churches historically have often played a role of trying to reconcile the underprivileged to society through reforms of the society. You know, the capitalists need to be more caring and we need to have a better way. But of course, none of this is an economic analysis. The capitalist system collapsed in 2008. Without government intervention, it would have all gone down the drain. Now, at that point, you haven't actually got a capitalist system. Most of these people who are making billions wouldn't even have their billions if the banks hadn't been bailed out. They'd have been bankrupted. And then, of course, the government would have had to take it over. And, of course, after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 and the takeover in China in the 1940s, there was actually, and even Cuba today, there was an alternative idea of what to do, and it wasn't based on capitalism at all. Now, I'm not saying that that worked. It didn't work. But on the other hand, the idea that you can resurrect a reformed capitalism out of the chaos of the current financial crisis,
I mean,
is absurd.
Yeah, Martin, would you agree with me that the far better approach is to get these various things which people are absolutely dependent on to live, such as food, water and shelter, and try and make them much cheaper or even free?
Well, I agree with that, but that's if you like, a kind of an emergency stopgap measure. The real truth.
Well, you could build it in structure, build it in for to the infrastructure. For example,
yes,
you know, for many, many years, water was paid as part of the rates by the owner of a house. The person that rented the house didn't pay those rates.
Yes, and in Ireland, water was absolutely free until the economic crisis of 2008. Nobody was charged for it at all. And that was obviously paid for out of general taxation. You know, the infrastructure was paid for, but nobody had to, it wasn't metered, you just took as much as you wanted.
It seems to me that a lot of these capitalists in the West, people who are, talk about themselves as entrepreneurs of generating wealth, have failed to do that because the Chinese have done a hell of a lot better at it, and they can't do that anymore. So what they're doing is they're finding the things that we're absolutely dependent on trying to monopolize them, take over those things, and make money for nothing, basically, because they know that we need them. And then, of course, that makes it a lot easier to do price fixing. So this is one of the symptoms of the death of capitalism, is
yes,
that all the people that used to make money doing something useful have now found the things that we're dependent on to live, and they're using those to rake off as much profit as they possibly can.
That's exactly what's the underlying agenda here. They want to monetize the environment. One of the things that they've put forward is this idea of social bonds, so that capitalists will invest in the reform of juvenile delinquents, for example. So these juvenile delinquents, if they are reformed and they, you know, they don't go back to prison or whatever, then the capitalist gets a payback. This is regarded as some kind of genius solution to social problems. Now, in a more robust era, we realise that basically the business, the instinct to make money is not the same as the instinct to make society function. They are actually, you know, contrary instincts. And you don't want to go too far down the road of saying we're not going to do any money making at all. We're just going to do everything just for social reasons. We're just going to have a plan and we're going to do X, Y and Z and that's what we're going to do. But on the other hand, the idea that you can reform society by everything being turned into a market so that rich people can invest in improving the lives of poorer people, it's just a load of flim-flam. If you're going
to change
things, sometimes you just have to say, right, we're taking over this industry that used to be run by you, and it's going to be run by the government, and that's the end of it. And there's no more money for you to make out of it.
Partly the problem with this, when you go around New Zealand at the moment, loads of places in towns and in the countryside, you see these stop three waters signs everywhere. What is three waters? Well, the government's new three waters scheme will take water services infrastructure off of 67 local authorities, local councils, and give it to four new entities that are not democratically accountable to the public. At the moment, everyone over 18 can participate in the way local authorities administer and charge them for water services by attending meetings or submitting on council long-term plans and exercising their vote at local elections. The three water scheme will take away all of those rights. So, you know, as I say, all the water infrastructure of the country basically being taken over by a non-democratically accountable organisation. It's very much like the privatisation, it seems to me, Martin, and a taking away of the water from the old water boards in the UK. But of course, it's a much bigger deal here because so many people are off the water grid.
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know the details of what these proposals are in New Zealand, but in Britain, the water, it was municipal enterprise by Joseph Chamberlain in Birmingham that created a municipal water company to supply water to the people of Birmingham. But it was not a private initiative. It was by the local council. And of course, he then bought up land in Wales to create reservoirs, which then used the water was then used. But when it was nationalised in the 1940s, all of this stuff, which actually belonged to Birmingham City Council, was transferred to the central government. Now, the central government then used to run all of the water boards in Britain, but of course Bristol.
The central government did not run all the water boards. The water boards were accountable to the region, the various.
All right, but, I mean, but in any case,
just like the electricity board, they have public representatives on those boards as well as professionals, and you know, it was much more transparent. This again is
all right,
you know,
but I mean, the point.
Anyway,
the point.
Martin, can we just move on, please, to have a listen to? And this is obviously we were listening to Prime Minister's questions from Westminster, but we're going to have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions from Wellington. I'm just trying to find the name of the very nice lady who was asking these questions this week to, I think it's the Finance Minister, Grant Thornton. That's it, Nicola Willis of the National Party, asking a question of Jacinda's Finance Minister, Grant Thornton. So New Zealand questions you're going to get here. She's, as she says here, $72 million. Has been quietly diverted from the COVID recovery fund to fund this three waters slush fund, as she calls it, without any recourse to Parliament at all. So Parliament is not been allowed to vote on its budget for money for this three waters programme because Jacinda knows that it would be unlikely to get through. So what they've done is they've got this $72.3 million from their COVID recovery fund to fund the takeover of New Zealand's individual people's water supplies. Let's have a listen to that now.
Question number six, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, does he stand by his statement about the COVID-19 Response and Recovery Fund that the fund is not there to be used for any old project in the Never Never? It is to provide support and stimulus to recover and rebuild from COVID-19. If so, does he support the drawdown and redirection of $72.3 million to help cover unfunded Department of Internal Affairs Three Waters work?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
In answer to the first question, which is with regards to a statement I made in July 2020, yes. And to the second part of the question, the member is incorrect in her description of the funding. In July 2020, a tag contingency of $710 million was established for Three Waters Infrastructure and Investment and Service Delivery Reform Program within the COVID Response and Recovery Fund. This included provision for policy work on the program. In April 2022, when that 2020 tag contingency was coming to an end, $72 million was allocated to program costs. I would note, Mr. Speaker, at the same time, $12.4 million was returned to the centre.
Does the Minister recall the Cabinet paper seeking agreement to reallocate $72 million of the unallocated portion of Three Waters Infrastructure Investment Program? For policy advice, And can he advise the House how spending $21 million of taxpayers' money on Three Waters policy advice and communications activity helps the New Zealand economy recover from COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, as we've discussed several times in this House, the member knows that the COVID response and recovery fund was designed to make sure that New Zealand could respond to COVID and recover from COVID. Part of that is making sure that we stimulate economic development in the regions. That includes, Mr. Speaker, I might say, through the Three Waters program, 291 kilometres of drinking water pipes, 159 kilometres of wastewater pipes, 128 upgrades to wastewater treatment plants all over New Zealand. The Three Waters program overall will contribute to a significant number of jobs being created in New Zealand, something I know the National Party has difficulty with.
How does spending $14.6 million of taxpayer money on supporting iwi Māori to participate, quote, in the Three Waters service delivery system, quote, help the New Zealand economy recover from COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, as I've just said in my previous answer, the Three Waters Reform Program is part of economic development right across New Zealand. I appreciate the National Party doesn't want iwi and Māori to participate in the New Zealand economy, but on this side of the House, we think that's a good idea.
Why did he take $3.6 million from the COVID fund and spend it on the future of local government review? And is this what he thinks New Zealanders expected would most help the recovery of the economy from COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, what I think most New Zealanders expected would happen in terms of the recovery from the from COVID was that the government would spend around $26 billion supporting employers to be able to keep their staff on, around $13 billion supporting small businesses with low-cost loans, around $10 billion for the health sector to be able to respond to COVID, around $5 billion from business and science and innovation support, around $4.7 billion to support people in housing, around $2.85 billion to support the education sector, around $1.85 billion to support the transport sector to keep going. Mr. Speaker, the vast bulk of the COVID-19 fund was spent directly on things related to recovery. Some was spent on response. Mr. Speaker, the member has many colleagues who asked us to spend a lot more money in COVID on other things.
Does he think it's prudent for the government to be spending $2.1 million on a swanky Freeman's Bay office for the hundreds of consultants and staff hired to work on Three Waters reforms? And could he tell the House whether this will also help with recovery from COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, I know that the National Party think that if a difficult problem comes along, the answer is to kick the can down the road, not deal with the massive rate increases that New Zealanders will have if we don't solve Three Waters, not worry whether people have good quality drinking water, not worry whether our waste systems work. It's all in the power of the National Party to say, we're going to kick that problem down the road. We're facing up to it. We're making sure those reforms happen so New Zealanders don't have to pay so much for their rates, for their water. National might not care about that. We do.
Does he recall stating in relation to the COVID fund that, quote, we are sticking to our word on this. We are investing money where it is needed to respond to COVID-19. And does he recall whether when he said those words, he was anticipating dipping into the COVID fund so he could avoid public scrutiny for throwing yet more taxpayer money at his unpopular Three Waters reforms?
Mr. Speaker, I stand by the record of this government of getting New Zealand through COVID, of saving lives and saving livelihoods. The fact that we spent $26 billion supporting New Zealand businesses has helped New Zealand have an unemployment rate of 3.3%. The fact that we spent that money supporting small businesses means that they didn't go out of business. The member might not like it, but the government's record on getting New Zealand through COVID is an excellent one that all New Zealanders should be proud of.
How cool is your slapper?
That was a little... It's interesting, completely different here, that the person asks a question, gets to ask them to... They have all the members of the cabinet in there together, and the questions get asked to all of them, but they also get a whole load of supplementary questions, Martin. The other thing I didn't realise was that the New Zealand pound used to be the currency here until 1967. They only went over to the New Zealand dollar in 1967. But, I mean, it's pretty clear what's going on here. They've got a whole load of money sitting around for COVID recovery. They're finding it very difficult to get budgets for this Three Waters programme voted through Parliament. Even Labour MPs don't, it seems, want to back this, even though they've got a majority. So they're using this COVID money, as Nicola Willis there says, the slush fund, to fund it. And they've basically started allocating the money from other budgets because they can't get this through the Parliament for taking over New Zealand's water supply. Now, I realise this is a bit obscure. We're on the other side of the world here. But in a way, it's, I think, illustrative of the actions that are being taken, where we're hearing about inclusive capitalism and these wonderful plans of the rich and powerful in the Western world. What is actually happening is far more tardy.
Well, you billed that as PMQs, but of course it was the finance minister who's answering the questions. It doesn't.
Well, but that's what happened. Yeah, well, she was there too. I mean, you didn't hear Jacinda, but they have everybody in there, and they all get questions fired at them from the MPs. All of the leaders of the government at the same time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting to compare to British PMQs because it's much more orderly, isn't it? You know, it's a different ball game.
I think maybe there's less MPs around to shout and holler.
Well, it's just to do with culture, Tony. Different mentality. It's the same if you go to the Polish Parliament where I went. You know, everybody talks, you know, it's very boring. It's like watching paint dry. It's very different from what you see in the House of Commons. Anyway, it's very hard to comment because I don't even know what the Three Waters program is. I don't know how popular isn't.
I mean, I think I've done a reasonable job.
Well, you've explained it, in actual fact, I think my friend Shelley actually worked for the Three Waters programme as a contractor.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, so there's money to be made by somebody. The point is, as far as I can understand from the limited information that we've got here, or that I've got, is they are, previously it was local authorities who control the water decisions in their area. And they are now trying to centralise that.
That's right.
In other words, there used to be local control, but now they're saying we're going to have national control and they're going to run it in a different way.
It's not that simple. It's also that there was very little intervention and very little intervention needed because people basically were in charge of their own water supplies on their own farms, some places which are... not a farm, just a small section of land. They run their own. I mean, it's a different kind of tradition.
Well, I know, but I mean, the point is presumably that the local authorities ran public infrastructure, and that's what's been transferred.
No, it isn't really, because it's individuals. I mean, so for example, the government wants to take over control of the water that runs off your roof into your tank, this sort of thing, and regulate it and tell you, no, you can't use that. It's not up to standard or whatever. And people are just really annoyed about it. Anyway, let's go back to the UK Prime Minister's questions and the real world in the UK of not inclusive capitalism, and have a listen to the question this week about child hunger and poverty.
British chairman.
Mr.
Speaker, does the Prime Minister remember back in February when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, when I informed him that due to his incompetence in that job, the children in my constituency would go to bed that night with no food in their tummy and no heat in their homes? What is he now going to do as Prime Minister to make sure that in every community in our country, children aren't in that situation in this hard winter ahead?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the absolute best way to ensure
that children do not grow up in poverty, which is something that none of us want to see, is to ensure that they do not grow up in a workless household. And the record under these governments is that 700,000 fewer children are growing up in workless households, and that's because Conservative governments create jobs for people, Mr. Speaker, and that's the best anti-poverty strategy that we have.
Well, that's just rubbish, isn't it? Because as we've seen again and again, not just on this programme, but any media that's doing its job is pointing out that work is no longer a route out of poverty, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, many nurses who've just voted to go on strike here for the first time go to food banks because they can't afford to live, largely because of the rents they have to pay on the salaries that they earn. And the idea that if everybody's working, there can't be any poverty, well, that's very much a view from the ivory tower of super wealth. I don't suppose Rishi Sunak's ever gone hungry or even met people who have. I mean, it's just a different universe, isn't it?
The structure of society has completely changed, it seems to me, where it's just impossible for somebody unskilled to get. I mean, you know, there's an encouragement, isn't it, of people to get into organised crime because they can make more money like that rather than. And of course, there's something disastrous about a society where having a full time job and you still need benefits to live. So anyway, let's go on to a similar question about, I mean, that was about child poverty and child hunger. This is where food banks in the UK have been actually running out of food.
Liam Byrne. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Tomorrow, across my constituency of Hodge Hill, I'll be delivering food bank collection crates because once more our food banks are running out of food. Does the Prime Minister understand the despair my constituents feel? That he is one of the richest men in Britain is doing so little. They don't like the truth, Mr. Speaker. Does he understand the despair my constituents feel that he is doing so little for the poorest in Britain by refusing to cancel the £3 billion tax break for non-doms who profit from our country but won't make our country their home?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm proud of my and this government's track record in supporting the most vulnerable in our society. And that will always continue. And it is a bit rich hearing from the gentleman who, the first person who reminded us what happens when the economy gets crashed by a Labour government. That's no way to help people. We will build a strong economy. That's what enables us to support the most vulnerable. That's what enables us to support strong public services.
Well, he's talking about building a strong economy, Marty, but it's getting weaker and weaker all the time. I mean, it does seem like he's in massive denial, this guy.
Well, that's right. I mean, the idea that they are the hard-headed ones who know how to grow the economy and all the Labour Party knows how to do is to redistribute is just wrong. Their model of the economy is wrong. Giving tax cuts to the wealthiest does not stimulate the economy. What they should be doing when Jeremy Hunt does his budget on November 17th is they should increase public expenditure, including paying public servants, you know, teachers, doctors, etc., and nurses. And it makes much more sense to have tax increases on the wealthy because the wealthy don't spend that money anyway. But they're going to have 80%, that's the rumour, 80% cuts in public expenditure and only 20% increase in taxes. But even that increase in taxes will go nowhere near. The top rate of tax in this country in the sovereign 1950s was 95%. And you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country without permission. That's all gone. We've now got a wealthy global class of which Rishi Sunak is a prominent member. If he wasn't being Chancellor of the Exchequer, he'd probably live in California with his Indian wife, who is a non-dom, which is why, of course, the Labour Party are picking up on this. The Labour Party are going to go for this. So it's a symbolic thing, isn't it? These people come to this country and they don't pay the full rate of tax. His wife was forced, when it was exposed, probably by Johnson's people, that she was a non-dom and not paying tax.
Well,
she volunteered to pony
well, that's
to
right.
Pony
I was,
up.
I was going to say she wasn't forced. She chose.
Yeah, well, she chose. But in other words, the Labour Party see this as a useful line of attack because that's they will close that loophole.
Are you in favour of these exchange controls? Because this seems to me is the keystone of individual nation states, that they actually ring fence their economy so that they can actually control it themselves. And what's happened over since the Thatcher era is that there's been developed a super rich elite, a transnational elite, people like Rishi Sunak, I suppose, people working for and with Goldman Sachs, etc. Who simply, you know, if the situation is not good for them in one country, they might just skip off somewhere else, and they certainly don't have any incentive to plan for that specific country. They're, you know, what they're doing is working as part of a control system, a policy network right across the Western world.
Well, I mean, the way we used to run things in the 1950s wasn't bad, and it wasn't bad in the 1960s either.
Well, and 60s, but and the, 60s and 70s.
Yes, in other words, it's not some kind of crazy thing, gosh, that's mad communistic ideology. This was just normal stuff for most countries. Now, having said that, once you have created a global transnational, you know, things have changed. You know, people can pick up a smartphone and send $1 million across the world with a keystroke.
I mean, this global system, Martin, a global thing is not working.
Yes, but you can't just rewind the video back to the 1950s.
I'm saying that. What I'm saying is that by introducing some more, limits on the wealth that can be transferred around the world, and say, for example, somebody in India just buying up, I mean, which is one of the things that were down in Axminster when I was down there a few months ago, chatting to one of the gas engineers that came to see us when we were sitting in the church. They were going around doing some sort of gas survey. He said, well, our company's owned by China. I mean, you've got foreign countries just completely owning and controlling your infrastructure and running it for their benefit, not for the benefit of the people in our country. Or, I mean, I'm not just talking about UK, obviously. I'm talking about individual nation states don't really seem to mean anything anymore.
Well, what's happened is a deliberate attempt to undermine the capacity of nation states to intervene, to manage their economies according to what they would like to do. And the turning point actually was in 1981 in France, when the Mitterrand government attempted to reflate their economy, which they'd, you know, previously it had been possible to do that. You just pump money in and your economy reflates. But of course the franc was then destroyed, and the economy started to tank out, and they had to back down. Now, it's all very well saying we want to have control of our currency and so all the rest of it, and manage our economy, but it's actually difficult to do when you've got all these sharks out there who are taking bites out of you.
Well, it's
now, in actual fact,
that then becomes
a question mark of how are we going to discipline global capital? And of course, there is a model appearing on the horizon, which is the Russians are effectively self-sufficient in virtually everything. So they believe, and I think they're probably right, that they are going to be immune from the crash in the West. And the more sanctions that have been piled on them over the last 8 years, they've had to do it all their own way. They've had to build up their own food supply, pay off all their debts so they don't owe anything, even though all their money has been confiscated by the West. And of course, they're saying that they're going to seize even more yachts of the super rich in Russia. Well, the Russian oligarch has just got to take their money back to Russia. So that's all to the good. And of course, the Chinese economy has always been somewhat it's enmeshed in the global economy, but you can't just take money in out of China without agreements.
Well, it's a
controlled system in a way that what we've got in this country,
Martin,
is a totally uncontrolled system.
Yeah, it seems to me that the Western system has been a total disaster.
It has. I mean, basically, what we were doing in the 50s and the 60s, we could have carried on doing it. I mean, Kalecki, the Polish-British economist, made these points in the 1950s. In the 1950s, everybody believed that government should control things in that way. It was the obvious solution. It wasn't communism, but it certainly wasn't old-fashioned capitalism. And that was the kind of economics I was taught at Oxford in the late 70s. You know, capitalism doesn't work like that anymore. We've reformed it. But, of course, what happened was that the wealthy classes never accepted that reform. So when we're talking about reforming capitalism, even de Rothschild and all the rest of it, capitalism was reformed and then they unreformed it. They made it back to being what it was before, where of course Britain was the centre of the world's financial system, and we just sucked in resources from the rest of the empire, which of course is exactly what goes on now. The City of London is a sub-part of the US system, and we suck in masses of resources from developing countries. We've been doing it for years, which is why they're poor and we're relatively rich, and that's what leads to conflicts, wars and all the rest of it, where we go to Afghanistan or Iraq to try and impose our will and the local kick us out with massive suffering. And of course this week that's reminded that it's come out that 64 children have been killed by British Army in Afghanistan, far more than they previously admitted. It's a Freedom of Information request by an NGO has uncovered that.
So we've got the COP27 going on still. I mean, it seems, I think it's almost it's 2 weeks that's happening, and tens of thousands of people attending. I'm not quite sure if anyone's done any accounting for just how much carbon they've used and whether they've planted enough trees as individuals, or maybe they just pay someone else to plant a tree. They're bringing everything into this bringing nature into the capitalist economy just seems to me a total disaster. But there is apparently some link to the southwest of England. At Prime Minister's Questions, there was a question relating to COP27 about the idea of floating offshore wind power. Now, I'm not quite sure how stable a floating offshore wind thing would be. I mean, I would have thought that a good big gust of wind would either blow it out into into the Bristol Channel or possibly blow it over. But anyway, apparently this is now a thing, floating offshore wind.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I welcome the commitments made by my right honourable friend at COP27 this week. If he wants to do something that really helps get us to net zero, improves our energy security and helps create new opportunities in places like Milford Haven, South Wales, South West England, can I urge him to really throw the full weight of his office behind delivering floating offshore wind in the Celtic Sea, and crucially ensure that decisions being taken now by the Crown Estate and the Treasury mean that the economic value, the jobs of this new industry stay here in the UK?
Well, can I praise my right honourable friend for highlighting the incredible potential of floating offshore wind technology to help us move to net zero. He's right about the opportunities in the Celtic Sea and for Wales more generally, and I can confirm to him that Crown Estate's leasing process is expected to deliver more seabed leases for many more projects.
So floating offshore wind is now a thing. I think it sounds to me like they're going to be putting these things around the Bristol Channel with the Treasury sitting down with King Charles and the Crown Estate. No doubt, of course, there is money in this for King Charles. It seems there's quite a lot going on offshore these days, particularly to do with wind power. And of course, people's electricity bills now going to pay King Charles rather than the old electricity boards or even the privatised energy companies.
Well, isn't it extraordinary that just slipped in about the Crown Estates? I mean, it's only recently we discovered that the offshore continental shelf of the country doesn't belong to the government. It belongs to the Crown. And literally, the money from it goes to them. And we didn't even know that until it was uncovered relatively recently. And that's called living in a feudal country. I don't suppose they own maybe they do own the offshore continental shelf of New Zealand. Perhaps they do. But they certainly own it here, but we didn't know. I've no idea whether offshore wind is viable or not, is a simple answer to that.
Well, obviously
there's some kind of lobby for it, because the government are going, yes, we're looking into this and it's all going
floating
ahead.
This is it. Offshore wind is. It's just whether a floating thing is going to work. I mean, they just seem to be ploughing energy and money into all of this sort of thing. I think it's probably a good time to bring up this whole business of the Extinction Rebellion people. I mean, they call themselves just Stop Oil, don't they?
Well, there's different groups, isn't there? And they're not all connected. They're overlapping.
Yes, they are. Actually, yes, they are. Just Stop Oil and Insulate Britain are both offshoots of Extinction Rebellion. They've been quite sensible. I was chatting with one of them, and they're saying, look, What we've realised is that if they if these groups get prosecuted or their funds get taken, we need to make sure that there is this sort of air gap between Extinction Rebellion and these organisations, which is why they've come up with these different names for the organisations.
Mm-hmm.
But the most worrying thing about this week's halting of the M25, I mean, for a start, this is I think, you know, campaigning lunacy, punishing the people who are the victims of the corrupt energy system and, you know, being forced into their cars, forced off the railways, etc. And then you have a go at them. You're not targeting the, as we were saying last week, you're not targeting the directors of this. That is to say, you know, the energy companies themselves, the fuel companies, AGMs and things like that. You're targeting the victims of their misdemeanors. But not only that, we saw the police, I think it was Surrey police, I'm not sure who, actually arresting a journalist who was trying to cover this. And even though they showed their press card, I think it was a her from LBC, stood on a bridge reporting on the protest going on some distance away nearby on the motorway itself. And the police came, she flashed her press card at them, and then they decided to put her in jail. Now, take her into custody. I'm not sure how long she was in a cell for. But, I mean, the point here is, I mean, we were as freelance journalists in Bristol, covering the genetic crops, etc., we were being arrested by the police. There was one reason that they were doing it, is because they wanted us to not be broadcasting. They wanted us to miss our deadlines. The footage we shot, they didn't want it to turn up on the news. So this idea of the police arresting journalists, Martin, and it seems almost, in a way, they are doing that in support of the protest that's going on below on the motorway.
Well, I don't know if they're doing it in support of the protests. That seems a bit of a step. They shouldn't be arresting journalists, obviously. Journalists are reporting what's happening. They're not participating in the protest. They are not blocking the motorway. There's no case for them to be arrested at all, is there? Whatever you think about what's happening down on the motorway.
So it's Hertfordshire Police, actually, that arrested this woman. I just think the police are kind of... There's something very wrong with police that think that some... It's Charlotte Lynch. She was arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to commit a public nuisance whilst reporting on the M25 in Hertfordshire on Tuesday. I mean, you know, you just can't make this stuff up. How can the police mistake a journalist flashing a press card, her talking on her microphone about a protest, but as if she's causing a public nuisance? I think that there is a temptation, I think, what goes on in these sort of situations is a temptation of the police press offices to want to control the narrative at these events. And there is, of course, quite a lot of criticism by journalists and by the public, in fact, sitting in their cars, of the failure of the police to act on many of these protests, where people are sort of sitting there and the police appear, whether it's true or not, to be standing around doing nothing.
Well, I mean, the police don't want the... I mean, you know, what could happen is, for example, the activists themselves could have a video crew up on the bridge filming the action. Now, the police would not be happy with that because, of course, they might be beating people up or something may be happening that they don't want people to see and so on. But even so, I would argue, even if the activists were doing it, they're not blocking the motorway. They're just filming, and therefore that's legal, surely.
I mean, how could she be causing a public nuisance?
This is the mood of the conservative grassroots and Priti Patel and all the rest of it. Protest is illegitimate. Now, obviously, I don't believe that. I'm a very experienced protester. I still don't actually agree with what they're doing, as I'm sure you don't, Tony, because it doesn't help. I'm not against people blocking motorways, you know. If there was a nuclear alert or whatever, you know, the plans were, we were all going to go out and block the missiles coming out of Greenham Common and all the rest of it. But you don't just do it randomly at any old event.
No.
And the other thing, I'd like to bring up is this attack on the attacks that are going on famous paintings. I mean, why has Van Gogh got to have his painting trashed?
It's just a way of getting to the news.
Well, I suppose it is, but it's it doesn't show much political sense.
Let's just think through. Let's think through this M25 protest for a minute. What if you're in an electric car and you've timed your journey specifically so that you can get round to a particular point and then charge your car at maybe one of the service areas on the M25, and then you find yourself with you're sitting in your car, you're using a little bit of power, and then you find that actually you've used all the power and that you can't now move because they're stopping electric cars as well. I just say earlier about this whole idea of tarmac and bitumen. You know, you need this stuff in order to make roads to run your electric cars on. And also, I mean, I would say I've been looking into a little bit here at the electric cars over here, which are just not practical. There's no infrastructure to charge the electric cars in New Zealand, really, very little. Well, there's a tiny amount, but the distances are much. It's a bit. Imagine it in Australia, you know, trying to drive across Australia in an electric car is the batteries. And anybody that's got an electric car or thinking of getting one should be very aware of the damage that's done to the batteries by fast charging them. So there's this major problem with electric cars that they take really the best way to charge them up is overnight, and the electricity you're using for that, it could be gas or it could be nuclear, etc. There's all sorts of things that it could be you're using to charge it. I think it's Planet of the Humans goes into some of this in a bit of depth, the way that you're basically just offshoring your energy to somewhere where you don't think about it and you think that you've got some sort of green thing and an electric car isn't. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that the batteries for these cars, you're talking about something like $30,000 New Zealand dollars for a replacement battery if it goes wrong. And the guarantees on these batteries when you buy a new car are going down and down. So we're talking about something like 6-year guarantee. Your battery then starts to go. And what really damages the batteries is the fast charging. So if you're, you know, there's been this massive encouragement for people to get these electric cars and saying, oh, it's okay, you can charge it up in next to no time if you can find a spare space at the service station to do that, obviously without having to wait for someone else to finish doing it. But the fast charging is really bad for the batteries. And what happens is, and I can tell you what causes the fires in these batteries, is when you put them on a fast charge, due to the chemical reactions inside these batteries, you're starting to get like what you would call whiskers of metal forming on the I think it's in the anodes and the cathodes. They talk about these the different poles inside the battery. And if those little whiskers of metal form and then touch each other within the battery, you get a fire. You can get a spark and a fire, and the battery can just catch light. And so it's largely the pressure that there's been in order to get these things charged up quickly, that you don't have to sit around twiddling your thumbs waiting for your car to get charged, that's damaging them. Anyway, so, you know, it's the whole thing, it doesn't seem to be me, has been thought through very well at all. So are you thinking about getting an electric car, Martin?
It's way beyond my means. I don't think about things like that. I mean, a lot of this stuff is virtue signalling, but on every level. We need to completely change the way we run things. But you know, people buying electric cars and the corporations making money out of selling them, Tesla and all the rest of it, we need to change capitalism. That means nationalizing the banks, land reform. It's probably going to mean, like in Brazil, it's possibly going to mean a civil war. You know, that's how serious it is. And it's not going to happen by capitalism reforming itself.
Railways for transport. You know,
well, that's definitely part of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. It's railways, not cars, railways.
No, exactly. And of course, they pitched that idea from the Brits. Very good. Well done, China. I mean, you know, as we were hearing the other week with the guy from Aslev, the real winners in the British setup for the railway, the racket that they've set up, are the banks, the Roscoes, the companies that actually own the rolling stock. They're the ones making massive, massive profits out of every time you want to use the railway. But there isn't any real proper interrogation of this and no will to change it. And if those if those the rolling stock was actually centrally owned, government owned or whatever, and hired out at cost to the train operating companies, well, forget that. Why not just go back to the old British rail system, where the government can then actually say, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to bring down rail fares by a quarter. Now, that would certainly stop people using their cars. Anyway, so let's go. There was another dig at Prime Minister's questions this week. I thought an excellent one against Rishi Sunak about his massive wealth and the fact that he's so totally out of touch with the public. So let's have a listen to this one about a question about what happens when you get ill. Is Rishi Sunak going to call up his local GP surgery? And if so, what might happen?
Carl Turner. Yeah.
If the Prime Minister or any member of his many households became unwell, would he start ringing the GP surgery at 8 o'clock each morning to not get an appointment? Would he go off to accident and emergency and wait 12 hours to be seen? Would he call an ambulance which wouldn't come? Or would he use some of his £750 million unearned wealth to pay privately and see somebody there and then?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful, and let me put on record my thanks to the fantastic team at the Friaridge Hospital in Northallerton, who provided excellent care to my family over the years. But the Honourable Gentleman is right to highlight the issue of people waiting unacceptably long for treatment that they need. That's why we've put record funding into the NHS to help with backlogs and waiting times this winter. It's why the Health Secretary and the Chancellor are discussing how best to deliver the reforms that we need, because I want to make sure that everyone gets the care they need, and we will continue to invest in more doctors, more nurses and more community scans so that we can deliver exactly that.
Well, it sounds to me like he's guaranteeing there's not going to be an NHS crisis this winter, Martin.
Well, I mean, he's saying what he has to say, which is I do care about the NHS. I think the person who asking the question said that his wealth was unearned. Now, I'm willing to accept that a large chunk of it probably is unearned. It's capital gains of one kind and another, but it's also slightly OTT because he obviously did do some work to get the wealth. Although, of course, he inherited a lot and he married a lot when he married into the one of the wealthiest families in India.
Well, I mean, think that's the point he's making.
Yeah, well, he's going to be questioned about these things, isn't he? He can't really escape from that, especially if he's got, as it looks like they're going to do, massive cuts in public expenditure in an already, you know, don't forget we've had rounds and rounds of cuts and austerity from the Tories. What's going to happen from an economics point of view is when they cut public expenditure next, as they plan to do, the economy's already gone into recession. We've heard this morning that it went into recession in July. And they're promising us 2 years of recession. When they say there's going to be 2 years of recession, it could easily be 10 years of recession. And you're not going to get out of a recession by cutting public expenditure. The Thatcherite philosophy that if you just cut public expenditure, capitalism spontaneously regenerates is wrong, wrong, wrong. We knew it was wrong in 1936. The Russians and the Chinese don't believe in it, and they're right.
Yeah, it could be they make such a disaster of this then that we have to have a great reset, couldn't it?
Well, it could. What's going to happen is there's going to be something pretty there's going to be a big change. It's a big inflection point, biggest inflection point since World War II, or perhaps since 1929, if we're talking in financial terms. The question is, who's going to control the outcomes? The wealthy classes, the financiers, the military-industrial complex in the West, they intend to control the outcomes. And so all of this nicey-nicey talk about how we're going to help everybody is just the cover story for their power grab. And of course, they may not get away with it because there are other forces at work, not least the fact that they don't understand their economics is drivel. You cannot cut your way out of a recession. And attempting to do so, like they will fail.
You seem to be very cynical about this Council for Inclusive Capitalism, that it could be just a cover for their power grab.
Well, it's pretty obvious, really, isn't it? I mean, who thinks anything else? I mean, that's the kind of thing they come out with. Even in the 19th century, they used to come out with this. There used to be criticism of capitalism. People say capitalism doesn't work. It's divisive. It's exploitative. It destroys the environment. All of these things have been said for well over 100 years. And the kind of things they came out with, what they used to come out with actually in the 70s and 60s, was capitalism has reformed itself. And to some extent it had, as I said earlier. But those reforms were destroyed. They were completely melted away by the 1980s. Well, and of course, we then go back to the 1890s, don't we? Where there is no safety net.
What we saw with the withdrawal of exchange controls and the privatisation of the infrastructure, much of it anyway, was really just turning everything into this, a whole bunch of infrastructure that could be bought up by anyone. We kind of go back to Whitney Webb and her book about blackmail or something. One Nation Under Blackmail.
One Nation right. Under Blackmail.
Is that, you know, you've effectively got, as was saying last week, you've got this, the Bormann network money, Nazi money from the Second World War, put into many, many big businesses that have now snapped up the infrastructure of pretty much the whole of the Western world that they're now able to price fix. Anyway, final question from PMQs, one for you, Martin, particularly, which is about education.
Manera Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I know the Prime Minister's been very busy failing to stand up to bullies, but in the real world, schools and colleges across the country looking after actual children are struggling to make ends meet. One London head teacher has scrapped plans for mental health counsellors. A head teacher in Twickenham is no longer filling teaching assistant vacancies, whilst another is axing school trips. So, Mr. Speaker, will the Prime Minister give pupils and parents a cast-iron guarantee that in next week's autumn statement there will be no real terms cuts to school and college budgets?
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, we've significantly increased funding going into schools over the next 2 years, but on top of that, it was important to this government to help those children who left behind their education opportunities during the pandemic, which is why we invested £5 billion to helping those children catch up, including unveiling the most comprehensive programme of tutoring that this country has ever seen. It is closing the attainment gap and disproportionately benefiting disadvantaged children, and it's something that I know all colleagues will get behind.
So can you just give us a paint a little picture of the situation in schools now? And I know you're working not in an academy school, but in a state school. It's effectively a local authority school still, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, the money that they put aside for kids to catch up after the pandemic, if you remember, the guy that put the programme together resigned because he said it was totally insufficient to the task. So when he boasts about we've spent this money, the person who was in charge of designing the programme resigned and said this is a trivial amount of money considering what we need to do here. And also, of course, the tutoring programme, they basically gave it to lots of private sector companies to do, but many of whom didn't have any tutors, so they had to go and recruit them rather than giving it directly to the schools. So that was another issue. And of course, the underlying problem here for schools and all other public services is when the inflation rate is around 10%, then your budget is 10% smaller than it was because it's not increased in real terms. What they've got to do is increase the budgets for the public sector in line with inflation. And they said, well, that's inflationary. Yeah, but the alternative is deflationary. You're asking...
But it's not. It's not. It's just keeping up with inflation, Martin. They say
it's inflationary. I don't say it's inflationary. That's what the government says.
Can you give us an idea of how things are at your school?
Well, what's happening where I am is we need extra TAs because we haven't got enough to cover the jobs that need to be done.
Teaching assistants,
but there is no money for them. So we're actually finding that we're not able to, deal with the kids that need the extra help because we haven't got enough people. Okay.
I mean, is there a case for putting those kids in a separate special school or something like that?
Well, it depends, doesn't it? I mean, some kids, yes. But they, you know, I mean, but the kid I'm working with at the moment actually is a special needs child. I've been transferred from the kid I was working with previously, and she is definitely going to a special school. She's got special needs, but she needs to have a case built up that she has special needs, you know, so we've got to build a case. She's been to see the doctor. We're building it up, and she will probably go to a special school. But the question of whether kids should or shouldn't be in special school is a specialist question. Some kids should, some kids shouldn't. Yeah. But in any case, there are no cheap options. Kids in special schools are more expensive than kids in mainstream.
Obviously, teachers are very much aware, what with the ballots and things that have been taking place, of the politics and the money around their profession. I wonder what is the morale like in teaching? Because a lot of teachers I speak to say there's far too much bureaucracy involved, and they'd rather just get on and teach the kids the way they would, way they want to, which is why they took up the career in the first place.
Well, look, there's so many issues in education that we could be here all night discussing them all. But the fundamental ones are to do with resources. Of course they are. There's been ballots on strikes by teachers. I'm not in a teaching union. I'm actually in Unison. But in Scotland, they are going on strike on the 24th of November. The EIS have voted to strike and they're going to go on strike. I suspect that will be similar in England and Wales when the ballots are held. And that's because in real terms, teachers' salaries have been eroded way below what they used to be. And they're not recruiting new people because they can get more money in the private sector with less aggro. And therefore and of course, what experienced people are taking early retirement, all of which really, you know, undermines the stability of the setup, not to mention all the other stupid things they've done over the years, which I could go on about all night, but we haven't got all
night. I think,
night.
In a way, you know, just the job of teaching is good for your morale. You know, it's quite nice to be around these young people and feel that you're contributing towards their future by teaching them. You know, it's quite difficult to actually get teachers to have a bad morale because it's just a decent,
well, the
a
people,
nice atmosphere.
I'll definitely concede this. The people who do it because they want to do it. But it's not all fun, Tony. Some kids are very challenging, and you can end up in court accused of doing things that you know, you've got to really think about every aspect of what you're doing. And some people, I mean, certainly in my case, if I could take retirement tomorrow, I would take it. Not that I dislike the job. It's just there's too much aggro and there's too many things, you know, and the money is I don't do it for the money. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So I know. Yeah. You mean you're having to claim universal credit at the same time?
Well, that's
time.
Right. I mean, lots of people are. 40% of people on universal credit are in work.
Yeah. So sorry, Richie. It ain't a route out of poverty. Anyway, a couple more items before the break, and we're going to have a listen now to, well, this, I mean, maybe we can discuss it a bit beforehand, Martin, the David Icke being banned from travelling to Europe. Apparently, he was due to speak at a peace rally in Amsterdam, and the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and others around the European Union have decided actually to ban him. I mean, I'm frustrated by this, and I'm looking at it in parallel with the BBC's Mariana Spring having a go at Richard D. Hall, who's another sort of, I suppose you might call, Icke's type conspiracy person. He's, you know, he would consider himself a journalist, but I've seen a lot of his investigations, which I completely disagree with. I mean, for example, he says that the Madeleine McCann abduction, it was actually the parents that he believes that abducted Madeleine McCann. He also says that it was holograms that hit the World Trade Center. And I mean, there are various other aspects to his work which I find suspicious, actually. It doesn't seem to me as if he's being honest. And I say the same about David Icke. Something similar about him is that he seems to be. Do you want to say something about this, Martin? These specific individuals who are supposedly the cutting edge of what's really going on, but actually they seem to be very deeply flawed.
Well, I've got, you know, one of the, Cass Sunstein, who was one of Obama's advisors, said we've got to infiltrate and subvert these challenging movements. So from my point of view, people who come trampling into my turf of military intelligence analysis with all this stuff about the moon's a spaceship and there were holograms involved in this is a wider issue of what are the limits of freedom of speech. I mean, people are allowed to have crackpot ideas. You can't have a law against that.
Fair to say that, yeah, some of these people, well, it could be crackpot ideas, but then they could be being controlled, and they
That's the point. I think there's deliberate. So look at somebody like Alex Jones. Yeah, he's what happens is something like 9/11 takes place. It's carried out by the deep state. I'm summarizing here, obviously, and of course they don't just do it. They then want to control the narrative subsequently. So they have a general narrative for the general population. Oh my God, these terrible terrorists are attacking us. We now need to go to war with X, Y, and Z. But they also want to control those who are critical. So when people start asking questions about 9/11, they go on the internet, and the first things they find is David Icke. They find all these other people who are not just talking about 9/11. They've got another agenda as well. Now, this is a very, from my point of view, a pain in the neck, because we want to have a serious discussion about a serious issue, which is basically terrorism, and these people want to talk about something else.
Martin, it's a bit more than that, I think. I think it's a bit more than a pain in the neck. Surely,
all right. Because, well, I'm just you know, using
think,
a phrase that says just
some of these individuals. Well, all I'm saying is, I think that, you know, what we're seeing steered and manipulated, possibly consciously, individuals who are there to be a sort of stick to beat, you know, a kind of straw man. I suppose
that's right. Just so anybody who questions 9/11 is a David Icke nut.
Yes. Yeah?
And David Icke, of course, has made a lot of money out, as has Alex Jones, made a lot of money out of being this kind of critic of society and all the rest of it.
Well, Alex Jones, as you may know, has just been ordered to he owes $1.5 billion to the families of the victims of Sandy Hook because he was going around saying it was a hoax. Now, you know, I don't agree that it was a hoax, but I also don't agree that he should be hit with some massive bill for saying so. Do you?
Well, he's probably got more than that to pay it. This is the point I'm making. You know, I mean, the world we live in has become very strange in that, you know, after 9/11 happened, virtually everybody just bought into the narrative because that's what they were being bombarded with. A minority started to see through it. I mean, I would include myself in that. And gradually more people woke up to the fact that this was a come on. But of course, there's all the field has already been, as people gradually wake up to it being a come on, the field has already been colonized by deliberately cookie people who can then be used to beat anybody who questions it over the head. Oh, I suppose you believe that, you know, there's no such thing as whatever as well. Yeah. And what I always try to do on this show and in general is you've got to unpack everything bit by bit by bit. Don't presume that just because so-and-so, something else is the same. It isn't. It's not the same. And of course, there is a massive psychological warfare operation going on all the time. There's huge amounts of money being spent on trying to steer public opinion around.
Well,
I'm
amazed. Okay, we've got two things here with the two biggies, both of whom, by the way, were at Bilderberg but didn't want to talk to me when we were there in 2013. Alex Jones in the United States hit with a $1.5 billion bill. David Icke told he's not allowed to travel to Europe. I mean, certainly we've got the thing called the First Amendment in the United States. I thought you could say what you wanted to in the United States without being destroyed by the courts. I mean, obviously this is a horrible thing to do. I'm always very wary of these calling things hoaxes because you've got to think about the families of victims of, say, for example, 7/7, you know. You have to be very careful about the way you report on that sort of thing.
What he was suggesting, Alex Jones, was that nobody had been killed at all and it was all crisis actors. Now, he's been sued by the families through the civil courts. It's not even the government that sued him. So, that he's been sued for damages. The US, there is freedom of speech, but you can be sued for damages for anything. And of course, obviously, that's what's happened in that case. I'm in general in favour of freedom of speech, even if I don't agree with it or fundamentally opposed to it. Well, but on the other hand, that doesn't mean that I can't say that I think, for example, Alex Jones looks very much as if he works for Mossad, because that is my opinion. And that's my freedom of speech.
Yes, you're right, exactly. And I think that's the point here, is that both Icke and Jones have been sort of bigged up over the decades. I remember seeing InfoWars back in the 1990s thinking, gosh, what an impressive website, before 9/11 had even happened.
Yeah. You wonder where did the money come from for that? If you're a genuine radical like we are, you know that money is very hard to come by for the kind of things we do. And these people appear like, they're already absolutely well-funded. They've got all of the marketing all worked out. How does that happen?
Well, it might also be, of course, that the individuals are surrounded by people who are advising them. I remember when David Icke came to visit me in my house in Bedminster in Bristol, he had these two guys with him who seemed to be constantly feeding him utter rubbish, talking about the Bilderbergers as a sort of place where they all dressed up in these big white capes like monks. And chanted and things like this, and they were telling.
If you think about it, this kind of childish critique is designed to protect the powerful, instead of accusing them of terrorism. You know, which could be arrested for and sent to prison. You're accusing them of dressing up in and communing with the spirits. Which, of course, sounds crazy. And then, of course, that can then be used with the general population to say the kind of people who believe this are blah-dee-blah-dee-blah.
Yeah, well, in fact, see, the thing is that's why Icke and Jones could actually be used as great public examples to create laws which actually restrict genuine journalism. And, I mean, I think it's very useful, I think, before we hear from Icke, to look at this amazing book. I would suggest anybody that's interested in this kind of topic has a good old read of it. It's called Agent Jack, The True Story of MI5's Secret Nazi Hunter. It was published by, written by Robert Hutton and published in 2019. He's very sort of flattering of Victor Rothschild, who was involved in the setting up of these agents in the Second World War. And there were two main operations which MI5 conducted in World War II as part of the Second World War, obviously the war with Germany. There was the Double Cross Network, which was a whole bunch of German spies who were over in the UK, detected by MI5 and then turned to work for the British. And they were used to great effect to send back information which was actually quite useful to the Germans for a long time. And then when it came to D-Day, they were fed complete misinformation, disinformation, and it completely convinced the Germans, for example, that the D-Day invasions were coming through Calais. So that was the Double Cross Network. Then there was the Fifth Column Network, which was British Nazi sabotage cells. So they were actually encouraged and controlled by MI5. So the idea here is that, you know, you've got people doing attacks in Britain, but this guy, Agent Jack, was encouraging all this, and the whole thing was being constantly watched by the security services. So I think maybe what's going on now is these similar sorts of techniques, Martin, are being used against the public, effectively, by the intelligence services. So, you know, what they're doing is they are steering the forces which the public, many of the people who are kind of waking up to the problems that are going on with the collapse of capitalism, and they're being led up the garden path by people who are either knowingly or unknowingly being controlled by the intelligence services.
I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, Brigade 77 has 1,000 employees, all of whom have the rank of officers. They spend all day, every day, making stuff up to put up on the internet. That's how powerful these things are, and that's just one organisation that we know about. People don't realise how powerful these organisations are, how deep they're embedded into the infrastructure of the media and all the rest of it. I think people are vaguely aware that there's a lot more going on than they realise. And of course, inevitably, with they've got plenty of things to keep their minds occupied. They can't spend all day stressing about the fact that the news is being manipulated, even if they suspect that it mostly is. And that's probably the best attitude to have. Just don't necessarily believe everything you hear, be sceptical.
Well, Putin calls it the empire of lies. And I think, in a way, he's absolutely right about that, is that we're getting, you know, obviously you can't lie permanently. You have to tell a few truths. But the idea that the handful of people that have got a take on what's really going on are well-known characters like Ike, I'm afraid, is just not right at all. It's incorrect. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to, and I think it's an important principle, really. That
yeah,
we
I
don't
mean,
just
I'm,
say,
not, I'm not in favour of being, him being banned, because, of course, no, that of course then not. Makes him sound as but, if he's dangerous,
well,
and therefore
bad.
People might
it's,
think
it's,
he's talking sense.
The idea is that, you know, if people like Ike are banned, and people, you know, ordinary journalists, proper journalists around the country think, well, he is a bit nutty, so it doesn't matter. Well, what starts happening, obviously, after that is that real journalists,
yeah, it's a matter of principle.
Journalists will be banned. I mean, he's a Trojan horse in a way for the destruction of free speech. But anyway, we've got to give him his free speech as well. So let's have a listen now to David Icke talking about the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte banning him from Europe and banning him coming to Amsterdam to talk at a peace rally because he thinks he might cause breaches of the peace and disrupt Europe with his words.
Rutte is not running the Netherlands for the people of that country. He's running it for the World Economic Forum. And Schwab set up a operation called the Young Leaders School, where he picks up, those that control him pick up, potential leaders, i.e. thoroughly corruptible people, to be the leaders of countries to impose this global great reset that he talks about, the transformation of human society into a global fascist dictatorship. Now, who's been through that school? Justin Trudeau, the fascist leader of the now fascist Canada. Macron in France, ditto. Ardern in New Zealand. Newsom, the governor of California, who's turned California fascist since the COVID era. These people are in place to impose a globalist dictated agenda on the entire world. So what is that agenda? It's to create a structure of society in which the tiny few at the top of the pyramid, people call it the 1%, in fact it's a lot less than 1%, have total control over the population of the world at the bottom of the pyramid. And in between that elite and the population is designed to be, and my God, the fancy dress people showed us what was planned in the Netherlands. There's planned to be a police military state, a merging of the two, of total brutality and merciless imposition. And the population is designed to be controlled by the few through dependency. Dependency on the few for survival. How do you bring that about? What you have to do is destroy the access to an independent income of the population. So that is what lockdown was really about. Was nothing to do with health scam, that. Was to do with dismantling small business, holding the economy globally under the waterline. So now they're pushing that on through their manufactured war in Ukraine, which is actually a proxy for a war between the West and Russia, eventually China too, they're using that to push up energy prices, as they are using the fake, utterly scientific nonsense of human-caused climate change to also transform the cost of energy. Transform the cost of energy, you transform the cost of everything, because everything needs energy. And thus, more businesses now are going out of being after the lockdown, now the energy prices. And they're forcing people more and more into dependency by the state. What else do you need to control the people? Food, to make them dependent. Food. And this is why during the lockdown period of the COVID fascism, the supply chain of food and the production of food chain was dismantled. Why does anyone think that Bill Gates, Mr. COVID fake jab that has killed so many and destroyed their health of even more? Why does anyone think that Gates is now the biggest owner of farmland in America? And so, why would the World Economic Forum frontman Mark Rutter target farmers and farming in the second biggest exporter of food in the world, the Netherlands? It's nothing to do with climate change. They know that's a scam. It's to do with using that as the excuse to dismantle farming and food production. And why would they not, if that's their goal as it is, target the second biggest exporter of food in the world? So, people of the Netherlands, farmers of the Netherlands, this is not just about targeting you. This is about a global agenda to make the entire population dependent for the basics of life on the tiny few. Thus, the many become dependent under the control of the few. And that's what this is really about. Rutter is not your friend. He is your enemy par excellence. So, where do we go from here? Well, the moronic people who long ago handed their minds to the state and authority, well, where are they going? They're going down the road to exactly what I'm talking about. And they'll do nothing about it. Too busy stopping those that are trying to warn them. So that leaves the rest of us. And there are three types of people. Two of the groups are responsible for every tyranny in history. And the third group is responsible for ending every tyranny in history. Group number one, those who mindlessly accept anything authority tells them without question. Oh, there's a deadly virus. Yeah, there's a deadly virus. Oh yeah, we got to have the fake vaccine so it will protect us from the fake virus. And they will just do whatever they're told and think whatever they're told to think. Then there is group number two, those that don't want to do what authority tells them, but they're terrified of not doing so because they fear the consequences. Those two groups together have been responsible for every tyranny in history. Fascism is not imposed by fascists. There's never enough of them. Fascism is imposed by the population acquiescing to fascism. See Nazi Germany. So if anyone says, well, what can we do? Well, you can get off your stiffen your backbone and stop being a wimp. There's a start. Look your children and grandchildren in the eye and tell them what you were doing when fascism was introduced. Oh, I was keeping me mouth shut. Or, even worse, I was trying to get that David Icke bloke banned who was warning us about it. And then there's group number three that has ended every tyranny in history. The true renegades of this human family. Those that see they're being lied to, who see where this is going and refuse to cooperate. The people who understand the most powerful word in the English language. No, no, no. English language or any other language. No, no, no. Not doing it. Not cooperating. If Rutter comes out of his government building and says, this is what we've decided. This is what I've been told to decide in his case. This is what's going to happen. If enough Dutch people say, sorry, mate, not doing it. He has no power. These people have no power except the power the population gives to them in the form of acquiescence. So, what can we do? There's nothing we can do. There is everything we can do. Stop giving your power to authority, and then you'll see authority never had power in the first place because it was always yours. And we've reached the point, I trust, that people with still got a brain cell on active duty will see from what's happened to me in this situation, where speaking at a peace rally, your opinion leads to 26 countries in concert banning you. But no, no, a few people can't control the world. It's not possible, is it? This is another step, what has happened. On the road, which is getting faster in terms of its direction and speed, to total global fascistic control.
So that's David Icke there, and I don't often have David Icke speeches, but I think it's absolutely appalling the way that he's been banned. I don't know if you how closely you're listening to that, Martin, but you know, I think he did actually a pretty good job critiquing some of the plans of the World Economic Forum, but then he drops in the fake virus. You know, so the virus is not fake. Anybody that thinks it is, I'm afraid, is just a complete dupe of disinformation. And so, you know, this is, I suppose, what is the problem with people like Icke, is that if they can get something like that so utterly wrong, it actually aids the deep state in that if people think that the virus is fake, then they're not going to go to Wuhan, and they're not going to go and have a look at Peter Daszak. And they're not going to have a look at the fact that this was a bioengineered virus if they think there was no virus at all. So this anyway. What do you make of that speech, Martin, and this whole idea of banning Icke from Europe?
Well, was he making the speech in Amsterdam, or was
no? No, I'm not sure where he was, but I think he was down at the coast somewhere. But it was just a response to being banned.
So he's been banned, but he's actually in the Netherlands when he's making the speech.
No,
All right.
I don't think he's look.
All right. Well, I'm just trying to ascertain the facts here.
He's
you know.
Talking to the Dutch on a video. He's
all right. Well, actually... I mean, one of the things, first things, obviously, that struck me was the doomy music in the background. You know, which is manipulative in itself. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you just don't have doomy music. You know, if what you want to say, you want to say, you don't have doomy music.
But what about what he's actually saying?
Well, what he's actually saying is there are some, you know, some things in there that I largely agree with, but there's other things that I don't agree with. And I think also it's so simplistic. All the people who go along with the things, they're all condemned as being, you know, mindless. Most
no,
well, people,
no, what he actually said, he used the word moronic.
Moronic,
well,
yeah. In other words, instead of engaging with people you don't agree with, all you have to do is say they're all morons because they buy into
well,
all
actually,
of this
what
stuff.
They are is they are targeted victims of psychological warfare
yes,
who
they,
are actually victims.
Well, that may be patronizing. They may just have different views than you. Yeah. They don't see it your way. And they may be wrong, but calling them morons doesn't get you anywhere much. And it's almost like a kind of a religious speech where there is a small elect band who've seen through all of this. And of course, it's a misuse of the word fascism. I understand because it's become such a kind of, you know, bandied around word that everybody just thinks they know what fascism is. But the idea that you can stop fascism by non-cooperation is simply wrong. It took the Red Army millions of casualties and loads of fighting to stop fascism. It wasn't just non-cooperation. And
no,
this,
exactly.
This is the delusion of the Western individualist mentality. That all we've got to do is withdraw our consent and then all of these evil forces will collapse. Now, of course, withdrawing your consent is the first step, but they won't just collapse because you've withdrawn your consent.
No, absolutely.
That's not the way it works.
And I mean, I think it's quite interesting the way he actually includes people like you and me and billions of people around the world that do believe that there was such a thing as COVID-19 in some of the most evil people on the planet who he utterly condemns because we believe in a fake virus. Now, he did something quite clever there and he said, well, if you believe in the fake virus, and that's why you had a jab. Well, hang on a minute. No,
that's right. Because in actual fact, this is quite a. I mean, obviously, we've debated this at length on this show.
Yeah,
all the ins and outs of this, and your position and my position are not exactly the same. But then, why should they be? Because the world is a complicated place,
that's
and
right.
People are going to have different views. I think that his appeal is very similar to the appeal of Greta Thunberg or the Extinction Rebellion people, although he's on a different path from them, which is, it's all simple. All you've got to do is free your mind, listen to me, Greta, David, whoever it is,
and then you're
free. And in actual fact, the complexities of the manipulation are not really gone into because there's too much detail involved.
He's saying basically people had a jab because they believed in a fake virus. But you see, this is in that sentence in itself just doesn't make sense. You know, they didn't believe in a fake virus. They believed in something which was real.
Yes, and of course they're saying that the jabs are not the same. The mRNA vaccines, which I think are very, very dodgy, and there's lots of evidence to show that there is something very seriously wrong with them. But in China and Russia, nobody has had an mRNA vaccine. They just haven't had them. And there was a lockdown in China, and which was released quite early because they perceived it as a biological warfare attack. Yeah. And this is the difference between people. Everything isn't just happening in your mind. There is also physical stuff. There's a war going on in Ukraine. People are dying. It's not just something on the telly.
He does their talk about, he's really particularly having a go at governments. And there is I found a fascinating, what I think is a really good critique of that. I mean, he seems to be pointing towards the World Economic Forum, but also the governments as the enemy. And, you know, you just don't do what they say, etc. Well, you know, actually, maybe you should just make your mind up one by one on anything that they say, and rather than just completely reject
that's
every government.
He's lumped Justin Trudeau, Jacinda Ardern, and Mark Rutter. I mean, they are all establishment politicians. I think that is, you know, that some of that rings true.
Yeah, well, I'm saying
the idea that Jacinda Ardern, whatever else she is not a fascist. She may have many failings, but fascism, it's just overdone. And what it sounds like to the ordinary people is accusing Jacinda Ardern of being a fascist. She may be manipulated by deeper people. It's quite clear that there is something very, very sinister going on in the Western deep state and has been for decades. But the average politician at her level won't necessarily know
anyway,
about
I'd
all
like,
of that.
I'd like to get on to look at this, I think, an excellent... I mean, I think it's completely wrong to blame governments for this. I see governments as being taken over, infiltrated by other forces. And it's nice to see an Australian woman, I'm not sure of her name, and any listeners who do know, it'd be interesting to know who she is and at least be able to put a link up to her stuff if she's a bit more public about... But anyway, here she is, and I picked up this, I think it was on Telegram or somewhere last week, talking about what she talks about here is a multi-dimensional trap that it seems that people like David Icke, bless him, and of course he shouldn't be banned, he should be able to speak, have his freedom of speech, the right to be wrong as well as the right to be right, he's kind of causing... problems by blaming governments and when actually governments are some of the only people who may be fighting back against the deep state. So anyway, let's have a listen now to this anonymous or not. She's not, I think, I'm not sure she meant to be anonymous, but this lady from Australia talking about this, what she sees that could be a multi-dimensional trap being set for us all by the World Economic Forum.
Are the globalists steering us all into a trap? And by all, I don't just mean the general population, but also those who consider themselves to be awake to the global agenda?
As things worsen economically around the globe, people are waking up to just how badly our governments have screwed us all. And we are already starting to see peaks of this in other countries. As they reach a point of losing their livelihoods, people are getting angry, and rightfully so. Of course, our governments are to blame, but we also have to realize that our governments have been infiltrated by the globalists over the last few decades. So I'm not very confident that the people, the everyday people, will identify that fact as they awaken to the reality that their livelihoods are being stripped away. I feel that as the majority of the population begin to wake up, that they will be waking up to an engineered perception, a deliberate perception, that the solution is to eradicate the government, without the benefit of seeing that the real problem is actually the globalists who have infiltrated their government. Those of us who have been learning about the way things really work, about the real agenda behind all of the upheaval in the world that's orchestrated by the 0.1%, understand that they want global corporate governance, that they want complete control on a global level. I don't think any of us disagree on that. Yet I'm still hearing so many people say that they understand this fact in one breath, then say that dismantling their government is going to be the solution in the next breath. And this is exactly what the globalists want. Think about it. What is it that they need to ensure that they can achieve their global corporate government and to strengthen their new world order? What is the one thing right now that is standing in their way? I strongly feel that to achieve their goal, that they need to dissolve our governments, because then the technocratic corporate globalist dictators can jump in to replace them. Are we the ones who should know better going to be led into a trap? Not only led, but will we be fooled into becoming the leaders of this civil disobedience? As the general population starts to feel the pain of inflation, food shortages, high interest rates, loss of income, who are they going to blame? And then will we get caught up in trying to dissolve our governments rather than trying to expose and actually remove the infiltration? If people dissolve their governments, who takes over? Think about it. I know some people would like to believe that it would be us, the people, but I think that maybe that's a little naive. We already know that the corporations are waiting with bated breath for a gap so they can jump in and take full control. If you take the time to look through the World Economic Forum website, They tell you time and time again that global corporations are going to govern us and that traditional institutions are no longer required, that artificial intelligence and a one-world technocratic corporate government where we own nothing will give us more equality. And the owning nothing part isn't just limited to humans. It means our countries will also own nothing. They are counting on us to further lose trust in our national governance. In fact, they've been instrumental in weakening our governments and our institutions via manipulation and infiltration for decades. So if you have a look at the strategic intelligence maps, I highly recommend this one on global governance, going over to the ones by country. So you'll find on all of the countries on these intelligence maps that they have a section called civic participation. So in Australia, it's actually under the future of democracy in Australia, under civic participation. If you go to Canada, it's under Canada on the international stage, civic participation over here. United States, it appears under future orientation of government. It's down here, and it's exactly the same on the UK as well. It's under future orientation of government, civic participation over there. So it says, bottom up, civic participation is flourishing as technology helps bring people together in significant numbers to take direct action and exercise civil disobedience. At the same time, top-down forms of civic participation are also gaining traction as processes like citizens' assemblies, participatory budgeting, and referendums are having a significant impact. This is occurring amid a general dilution of hierarchies and a growing tension between the local and the global as digitalization reshuffles the traditional logic of power. And then if you go into shifts in power, which is also on every country's strategic intelligence map, it goes on to say, as trust in traditional institutions declines, other entities are seeking to take their place. Civic participation generally occurs in an always moving, ever-changing environment. On one hand, trusting governments and in traditional institutions like political parties, trade unions, and organized religion has been declining in many parts of the world. On the other hand, other entities are filling in the resulting gaps. Global corporations have gained greater amounts of power and influence. In particular, the technology companies that are proactively inserting themselves into policy and into political discussions. So as you can see, it's already written. This is their script. This is their plan. They want us to tear it all down so they can build it back. It seems to me that they're counting on us to be triggered into acting like, you know, a footy crowd and not using our discernment and not having an understanding of the bigger agenda so that we fall into some false sense of security of believing that all we have to do is dismantle and dissolve our governments to stop it all. Are we going to fall into their trap? Are we going to play the role of dismantling our own institutions rather than removing the NGOs and the corporate global entities that have actually infiltrated them?
Well, that's a good question. Anyway, I rather like that. Martin, what do you make of her little talk there?
Well, I think there's a lot to be recommended. I mean, whoever she is, this idea that the governments are the problem. I mean, do you remember back in when Cameron was elected, the Tories had a slogan, big government, big problem. And of course, they try to get into the anti-authoritarian mentality of a younger generation. Of course, we're all against the government. But of course, the government is what tamed the corporations back in the glory years after the Second World War. When the Bretton Woods conference took place to design the financial architecture, post-war architecture, there were no financiers present. It was all just government. Whereas at COP27 in Egypt, which of course is still a repressive military dictatorship, which I think we ought to mention, perhaps they need an armed uprising like in Syria. Only joking, folks. There's more oil industry lobbyists at COP27 than there are delegates. from the different countries. And this is, you know, they are basically trying to steer the natural rebellion of the populations all over the world against the failures of capitalism into an agenda which they have preformed. And that you know, if you are a young person and you're unhappy with the way society is going, you just sign up here and we'll give you a preformed ideology to control your thinking.
Yeah, it's a bit audacious. That's a big lie they're telling then.
Yeah, well, one of the things that makes it obvious to me, and obviously we're not in part two yet, is how widespread the support for the Ukrainian fascists, and they are fascists, you know, let's not kid ourselves, they're the real deal, across the liberal, left, green spectrum in this country and elsewhere. If you say anything against the sainted Zelensky, you are clearly an evil fascist. Whereas in actual fact, they've lost their marbles. You know, Zelensky is heading up probably the only genuinely fascist government in Europe. And yet we're all supposed to line up.
He's an actor.
Well, I know. Yes, he's a front man for what's going on. And he was chosen by Colin Moisky.
And he is an actor.
Yes, he is an actor. And of course, he's given a script. Now, I think that just shows how easily... I mean, I was shocked when all this kicked in at the beginning of this year, because it was so obvious to me that people were just going along. And, you know, I listen to Radio 3 quite a lot, and Radio 3 has got quite a sort of woke mentality, you know. They're not to be regarded as somehow conservative in their views or whatever. I mean, arty people tend to be quite lefty. But they've just gone completely gaga for pro-Ukraine propaganda, which is definitely manipulation by the deep state. So the kind of people that used to go into the streets to oppose the Iraq war are chanting at Glastonbury for more arms for the Ukrainians.
Can I just say something, please? You've been talking quite a lot here. Saying led by the nose by people like Paul Mason, amazingly.
Well, yes, I mean, he's a very clear example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
he's got the ludicrous idea that Zelensky is somehow represents republic. It's like the Spanish Civil War, and Zelensky represents the progressive forces, which is just absurd.
We're living in an age of mass propaganda, although I think, you know, as George Orwell said in his resignation letter to the BBC in the Second World War, he said, well, it doesn't actually work. Ultimately, propaganda might make you feel better and you think that people are being convinced, but gradually, he doesn't, well, I'm paraphrasing Orwell, gradually, the people that you're trying to convince realize that you're lying to them. And so ultimately, it's counterproductive. Anyway, let's just go to the final item before the break. Queen Elizabeth's funeral plans were shared with Iraq Hero before Her Majesty died. So this is a little bit suspect. 2 days before the Queen died, that is to say the same day that she was making Liz Truss the Prime Minister up at Balmoral. This is this chap called Bahari. He is a Victoria Cross. He's got a Victoria Cross. He said 2 days before Her Majesty's passing, I got an email asking me if I could confirm I'm definitely available if Operation London Bridge happens. Obviously, Operation London Bridge is the preparations for the death of the Queen. He says, I never replied. Operation London Bridge was the code name for the plans in place for the event of Queen Elizabeth's death. The veteran added, the following day, I had a phone call saying, we need you to confirm yes or no. If you're happy to go through with it, if Operation London Bridge happened. So, you know, this is a little bit, you know, there's obviously something wrong with the Queen. There were worries 2 days before she died that she was about to die, and these people are being, you know, I'm imagining he's not the only one who got the email. The Iraq War Hero was 25 years old when he met Queen Elizabeth in 2005. She awarded him the Victoria Cross for saving around 30 comrades whilst on the front lines, which led to the veteran suffering life-threatening brain injuries. But he's come to the Sun on Sunday to say, look, asked to be ready for the Queen to die 2 days before she did. And yet we're told she just died of old age. I think that she was suffering from something, Martin. And we've had quite a lot of discussion on here about what happened on the day she died, with the time of death obviously not being correct. It's almost certain that she died before the 2 p.m., when the BBC News website went black. So this is really just, ticking away various anomalies to do with the death of the Queen. And in the background to all of this, of course, the reason I'm doing this is because we now know that her grandfather, King George V, was most definitely murdered. He was murdered by, some people say euthanized, others say murdered. Because it's all there in the doctor's diaries that killed him, most probably, we're not entirely sure, but he was actually up at Sandringham at the time, Edward VIII, who then turned out to be a Nazi. Now, the most likely reason was that George V was considering possibilities of passing Edward VIII over because he believed he was a bit too much of a Nazi and not appropriate to take over the country he wanted. He was beginning to ask that the people looked into ways that he could pass the throne on to George VI, who eventually did. So this is why I think there needs to be very close examination of the death of the Queen, since we know what happened to her granddad.
Well, all I'll say about all of that is it's highly speculative, Tony. That's all I'll say.
Okay, well, let's have a break and we'll be back to talk a bit about New Zealand, but obviously also the US elections, the big empire. We need to know what's going on and if it's actually a democracy or not.
Broken brothers. A god. Chahawanswa Usa Chipamhitsere is the title of the track, and that's from the Four Brothers from their new LP, Imbareko Yakaramba.
We'll be right back.
One yet, I think. I like that a lot. That's Fluke Insertion, The Allotment of Blighty, the somewhat enigmatic title of it.
Yeah, so it's nice to have a bit of John Peel back announcing these things. I used to sit there and listen, and if I heard a good tune, this is even when I was out living out in the middle of nowhere in Ireland, and suddenly leap on the press play and record, and always try and leave it until you've got the Peel's back announcement as well. So I know there was a chap in Ralph in Oxford I used to know, and we used to work with, who did exactly the same. So there are people right around the country, thankfully, that have got these old cassette tapes with fantastic amounts of Peel from the 90s up until his sad death. So the music there, we heard the Morriston Orpheus Choir, Welsh Male Voice Choir, Mansions of the Lord. After that, as John was telling us, we had the Four Brothers, and then the Allotment of Blighty from Fluke. So that's our selection of music for today. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, you're safe in our hands, folks. You know, actually, a lot of the press now is just being used to gaslight people. We are talking on the new-ish talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, as well as on radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, and joining me is Irish Republican Labour activist as ever, Martin Summers. Martin, do you want to say something about the US elections? Because that's how we're going to kick off with Don DeBar. I thought it was fascinating that he's a former communist that joined Pacifica Radio, and then he's actually got quite a lot of sympathy for Donald Trump, and he saw Donald Trump as causing more trouble for the deep state in the US than anyone from the left, for whatever reason. But anyway, what do you make of the midterms?
Well, it's still in the balance, isn't it? I mean, the things I've been reading, obviously it's only the last day or so that it's all been coming out, is that the Republicans didn't do as well as they had hoped, and the Democrats didn't do as badly as they had feared. But it's quite likely that I think that the Democrats are going to lose control of the Senate or the House or both.
Yeah, it looks like both, actually.
That was the general opinion that was likely to happen anyway.
So, I mean, you know, I think another thing which Don is, I'm not sure if this is part of the clip, I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is he says that the approval rating of Biden is as low as President Nixon was during the Watergate crisis in the couple of days before he resigned. So it's not a ringing endorsement. I don't think the American population are really, even the Democrats, warm to Biden at all.
Martin,
you're interrupting. Please, just let me finish the sentence. It would have been a completely different story if we'd had somebody like Bernie as the Democratic president.
Well, he wouldn't have been the presidential candidate. He wouldn't have been the president. But yes, I mean, Biden was...
If he would have been elected, he would have been the president.
Well, he might have been elected. It's a counterfactual. We don't know. He might have been.
Look, are you saying that you think Biden stood a better chance of getting elected president than Bernie Sanders?
Well, no, it's Hillary Clinton, isn't it, that we were talking about in the first case, and then Biden in the second case, because he was denied the nomination both times by the machinations of the deep state.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, so let's plunge straight in with Don DeBar now. And he explains to me why he thinks that Trump was correct to demonstrate. This is Don DeBar, who's a former Pacifica Radio journalist in New York. And he's talking here about the midterm elections. But I think, you know, we need to know what was going on on the January the 6th, isn't it, 2020, when all this is terrible stuff was supposed to happen just after the Biden was elected. And we're told that it was an insurrection, quite clearly. We heard from Don last week that it wasn't. So what was really going on? Why was there a demonstration, and what was it hoping to achieve?
Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution says, "The federal election, including the presidential election, shall be conducted according to laws and rules determined by the state legislature." Now, the election law in those states that existed before the governor or the attorney general, or in some cases the board of elections, decided to change it substantially where it impacted the election. I mean, those numbers are clearly identifiable as these ballots are in this class that was created by this change, and this is the impact that they had on the outcome. That's clearly identifiable. Under Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, those changes are invalid under the U.S. Constitution. That was the basis that was going to be used. First of all, the courts would not entertain that question. And it's a fundamental one, a fundamental matter of law, which is really suspicious because they tried it in multiple states and in the federal courts, multiple district courts. And there were a million, I'll use the BS, reasons why they never got to the merits in any of those cases. You filed too early, you filed too late, you served the wrong party. Also, they call them threshold issues. When a court doesn't want to entertain something, there are a million different technical reasons why the court doesn't have to listen to the case, doesn't have to take the case. But this was wall-to-wall unanimity on this particular question. A couple of them said, we do not think the judiciary should reach in and change the outcome of the vote. But the fundamental question was, who was supposed to vote according to the law that was adopted under the constitutional provision? So what they were going to do on January 6th was object. There were senators that said, we will join in the objections. So Arizona was the first case. It was the first state where they were going to do this. And senators said, join in the objection. Now, everyone knows that when they go to their respective chambers, and after they have the trial, in other words, they actually have a trial on the facts and law in front of TV cameras so the world can see what happened. After they do that, there's a vote in each of the two houses, full vote, and unless both houses say we sustain the challenge, those votes are accepted. The Democrats control both houses. No matter what the facts were or the law or how ugly it got or whatever, there was no way that they were going to vote to disallow this and let Trump become president. Everyone knew that going into it. What was intended was to lay bare the facts of what actually happened in the 2020 election so the world could see it. That's what was underway when the Capitol was breached. And instead of there being an afternoon where America watched on C-SPAN how the election was stolen in violation of the U.S. Constitution, they saw that Donald Trump's mad mob threatened the very foundation of American democracy and that he was an irresponsible player who should be banned from politics. And no one in the room should dare raise their voice given the severity of the threat to democracy that we have just experienced in this 11 and a half hour TV show that took place from when the Capitol was breached until they restored order.
So that's Don DeBar, first clip from him. What he's saying, Martin, is actually was some quite serious wrangling going on in the House of Representatives and the Senate about whether or not those elections were legal, and the TV show basically completely obscured that and diverted the public's attention away from the fact that that there were serious legal challenges going on in the background.
Well, as he pointed out, none of them were successful. And for, you know, independent observers around the world, if none of them are successful, that tends to suggest there's nothing there to see. I'll just put that on one side for a moment, because I'm willing to accept that elections in the US are rigged. They've always been rigged. It's not a new thing. They've been rigged for years. Not least through what Greg Pallister's documented of voter suppression, which of course is going to be an issue in May in this country.
That's right. He talks about that in the longer interview. But I also asked Don, who's really in charge of the United States? You know, we obviously know that these presidents are, you know, even Trump, who some people see as kind of anti the deep state. And, you know, maybe there's aspects of Trump. You know, obviously, he was working with the mafia in New York. He's a mega rich guy. He's, you know, he's not just an ordinary Joe of any sort. So who's really running the United States?
Follow the money. I mean, oil companies and arms manufacturers are, you know, they do pretty well here. And they have a piece of everyone's tail around the planet pretty much, right? Europe certainly is certainly more beholden to American energy companies now than they were, say, 10 months ago. And it seems like this is a long-term marriage by shotgun that's, unless there's some, you know, way of reaching a modus vivendi with Russia and OPEC now, right? Unless Juan Guaido can come up with some oil. You know, let's look at this election, because I've kind of done all this to set that up, and I think that'll help answer the question you just asked. Because of all of these things, rather than Democrats getting a rout, there was a chunk of the vote that bought into the narrative that there is an existential threat to democracy in the United States, represented by Trump and that faction of Republicans, and consequently, they you can't vote for them. Biden said it. A whole lot of them said it. This democracy is on the ballot. Some people believed it. Now, The actual campaign, when you have World War III going on, and forget whether or not we're going to have a nuclear war, we spent more money in Ukraine than we spent on any war in history before in that period of time. We spent more than the annual Russian military budget on Ukraine. We spent more than the annual housing and urban development budget on Ukraine. We spent more than the annual food assistance program in the United States in Ukraine. We spent more than that. So, and this is at a time when food security, housing security, medical care security, college debt, these are all record, burdens on the population. And this is, 40 years into austerity, just like in Europe. And so there's a whole, set of fundamental problems that were completely left out of the political narrative for this election, which was about democracy and abortion and LGBTQ rights. And yet, with all of the unanimity of opinion across the media, and with all of the data that they were able to gather from all the social media over the last 20 years and bring to bear on the problem, the Democrats did lose the House. There was a cluster of maybe 75 to 80 now Republican members of the House of Representatives who have no intention of funding Ukraine one step further. They are going to be a significant voice in picking the next Speaker of the House. And it's going to be a significant issue for them. There are some changes that I think we're going to see regardless of what happens in the Senate. And it may well be after the runoff election in Georgia, because there's a runoff election coming in Georgia, that the Republicans will have control of both houses. You can look at the Clinton presidency as an example of what happens when the other party has control of the Congress. And the same with Obama. I think even more so because there are some fundamental questions of international policy that there's some deep disagreement between the mainstream Republicans or formerly mainstream Republicans and the Democrats and the intelligence community and the media on the one hand, and on this new group of Republican insurgents, and on the guy who's leading in polls for presidency in 2024, Donald Trump, on the other hand.
The Republicans are set to take over, basically.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Looking at the results, Martin, at the moment, they're still counting over there. And by the way, if you're interested in the US electoral system, in our Masters of the Empire over the other side of the pond, then actually Don does, I think, at the beginning of the interview I did with him, which is about a 50-minute long interview, he does a really good explanation of how the US elections work, because, of course, these midterms include all sorts of things. I think it's the entire House of Representatives and half of the Senate, something like that. It's a little bit quite complicated, but the way it's looking at the moment, in the Senate, the Republicans have 49, the Democrats 48. The House of Representatives, the Republicans have got 211 and the Democrats 197. So obviously the Republicans doing quite well, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, which was expected. In a way, that what's happening is not out of line with what most people expected to happen. So if the elections are being rigged, then the Republicans are doing rather well in the face of it. But of course, elections are rigged in the United States. There's some fundamental things wrong with the way they do stuff. For example, the Senate has two senators for every state in the union. And that means that small...
That's right, like the rotten boroughs, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So the Senate has got a pretty guaranteed conservative bias, which is how it was originally designed by the founding fathers, because they didn't really believe in full-on democracy. They believed, as did radicals in this country, that you have a balanced system where there's a democratic vote, but you have a House of Lords or something similar to make sure that they can't just ride roughshod over the land. Landowners and so forth,
interesting to look at the BBC coverage of this. I mean, they've got an article up, Carrie Lake interviewing the election denier who could be Arizona governor. Well,
as Don explains in a longer interview, and partly what we've just heard, there are absolutely legitimate legal challenges and questions about the legitimacy of the US elections. I mean, the idea is that an election denier, I mean, what a ridiculous word for the, I'm seeing is this Katty Kay, the US special correspondent for the BBC, talks about Carrie Lake in Arizona. Now, Arizona was one of the states where there were some serious legal questions about the legality of the previous election, you know, where Biden and Trump was booted out, and Biden, and there's obviously a very concerted attempt by the deep state in the United States to make sure that Trump is not allowed to run again for whatever reason, which he agrees with. Anyway, so a longer interview is there, but I thought we'd just, whilst having a chat to Don DeBar, we'd dip into an interview on the Tucker Carlson show with the lawyer Harmeet Dhillon, who has a lot of interesting things to say, I think, about the delays to the count that's going on at the moment in Arizona, or was going on anyway this time yesterday. Speaking on the Tucker Carlson show, she explains that there are all sorts of very definite and real legal problems with the way that the US, and we're going to be hearing a bit more, and we'll hear from you, Martin, after we've heard from Harmeet Dhillon, the US lawyer, about the delays in counting the votes in Arizona.
These are long voting lines in Arizona. That was yesterday's chaos at polling sites across the state, particularly in Maricopa County, the population center of Arizona. That chaos continues today. This is a live picture from vote counting underway in that county, which includes Tempe and Phoenix. We are told we received new results at the top of the hour out of that county, but they are apparently still delayed. What is going on exactly? Harmeet Dhillon is the chairwoman of the Republican National Lawyers Association. She's in Phoenix tonight, where legal challenges may soon be underway. She joins us now. Harmeet, great to see you. What is the latest in these two races?
Well, the latest, Tucker, is that the Maricopa County party is like way behind. The county is way behind in counting these votes. And one of the reasons here is that they switched a couple of years ago to what's called a vote center model. So instead of the old-fashioned model where you would go vote in a precinct, they actually cut the number of places you could vote by two-thirds. So it made it a little harder and less accessible to vote. And then they don't have pre-printed ballots when you go to vote. So wherever you wander and show up, they then print a ballot for you, which takes time. And if the printers are screwed up and the tabulators are screwed up, which is what happened in Maricopa County despite testing, which is the job of the county officials, then you have the chaos that you're seeing on the screen there. And you have two-hour lines. You have poorly trained election officials who aren't used to this model telling people they can just go to another place to vote, but they can't. When they go to the next place, they're told they've already voted. This disenfranchised voters yesterday, and we went to court with the two campaigns and the RNC to go and try to get a judge to keep the Maricopa County voting places open longer. The judge rejected this, and so people were disenfranchised by this chaos. And so there's a lot of things that when Carrie Lake becomes the governor of Arizona, she needs to do to convene a legislative session to make several changes, I believe, to Arizona law so that this never happens again and that people can have confidence in the outcome of the elections here. We still have a third of the ballots that haven't been counted. I mean, compare and contrast that with Florida, where they had results very quickly. And that's as a result of all this experimentation and other shenanigans that are going on, like Mark Zuckerberg's organizations still giving in-kind contributions to the recorder's offices in Arizona, even though Zuckerbucks have been banned. So I could go on and on. There are many problems with Arizona voting, but we're pretty close to hopefully getting a couple of new leaders there who will help turn things around.
Yeah, this stuff really matters, and shame on the outgoing governor, I would say, and the Secretary of State. Harmeet Dhillon, thank you very much for that update.
What I think is so fascinating about it is the Zuckerbucks apparently paying to help in the administration of these elections, Martin. And you know, this is exactly what's been going on, I think, at an international level too. Whereas these big international institutions like the UN get strapped for cash, so these big corporations come along, the World Economic Forum. In that case, Zuckerberg apparently paying towards the cost of the elections in Arizona.
Well, obviously, I don't know the detail of that. What I would say is it's always been the case that because America is such a big country, that the elections what happens in elections varies enormously depending on where you are. So traditionally, for example, in the South, like in Arizona, blacks were excluded from the voting register by all kinds of underhand methods, which of course is what led to the civil rights movement in the 60s and so on. And of course, you know, in the big cities like Chicago, the Democrats were a shoo-in, and then you got the Tammany Hall machine controlling what went on and who got to vote, and the mafia got their fingers on the scale and all the rest of it.
Which seemed to me that it's much simpler to have a system where you actually just get a piece of paper and you tick the box on there, which they don't seem to want to do. That I asked Don about voter machine fraud as well.
Matter of fact, in 2004, so we're going back 18 years, a gentleman named Nick Mottern, M-O-T-T-E-R-N, enlisted me and a number of other people to review a bunch of evidence that they had collected in Ohio, both in terms of testimony on videotape, affidavits, and then actual mechanical evidence from machines. And work product from machines that the vote was stolen in Ohio and Columbus and a couple of other places. And we put this stuff together while the process that I described before was going on. So the election was in November. This was like in December when it's still before it's finalized, January 6th. And we took it to the FBI office because it's a federal crime to tamper with elections, and federal jurisdiction, so you can take it to any FBI office. And we happened to know where the one was where we are, and we happened to both live here, and we had all the work here, so we took it there. And that was the first time, and they refused to see us after we told them why we wanted to see them. And so we left. We held a press conference. The second time, we held a press conference before we went in from outside, and we had the press come in with us, along with a dozen people who were carrying signs and stuff. Anyway, it took us a week of doing this in the snow, by the way. It was early December, mid-December, before they finally took the complaint. That was the end of it. We never heard anything back after they took our envelope.
So there you go. The FBI has given a load of evidence about election fraud. They do nothing about it. I mean, it does make you wonder whether America is a democracy, and of course it's not, really. So I asked also Don about China and Russia. You can hear that in the final version of the interview. But I just think, Martin, you know, we need to really understand what's going on in the US. Do you think it's going to make much difference? He did talk there about that the Republicans are much more likely to push back against the Ukraine war than the Democrats. Now, you know, he knows his stuff in the US. This might mean that maybe less money will be being shoveled towards propping up Zelensky as a result of these elections.
I have my doubts. The Republicans, if they are, nobody is openly opposed the war on any level in the US, apart maybe from Tulsi Gabbard, who's now out of politics. Can I just make a general point about the US, which is, it is not a democratic system, and it wasn't designed as a democratic system. The electoral college system for electing the president means that quite frequently people who get less votes become the president with all the power that the president has, supposedly, on paper. So I don't think even the Republicans would claim that Donald Trump got more votes than Biden. He didn't, but the electoral college would have been flipped if certain states had gone the other way, which is why they're getting upset about Arizona in particular, which is a traditional Republican state, Democrats. The point about this is, if you are the only democracy on the planet, or the first democracy on the planet, as the US claims to be, then you can run it any way you like, and the people get less votes can win because it's a federal system. Yeah. So all of the votes for a particular state, California, for example, all go one way. They don't break the vote down, which means is that people with less votes can win. That cannot happen in Russia. It cannot happen. Putin has won every vote he stood in, because he won fair and square, and the votes are all counted. Each vote counts. Okay, it's a proportional system. It's actually a there's actually a runoff system as you've got in France. So in
the US, Martin, you're just going on about this. I'm sorry, but we need to keep going. You know, we need to move on to different subjects.
I'm just trying to put some context on this.
Well, just try and be a bit more concise, could you please? I'm not trying to censor you. I'm not trying to shut you up. It's just that I think you need to just, you know, try and make your points and come to them a little bit quicker if you can. So we're going to take a look now, and I think, I'm afraid I go with Don DeBar when it comes to putting pressure on NATO and the Pentagon not to have this war. I think the Republicans are more likely to do that than the Democrats. Anyway, so Steve Cranston is a farmer near Hamilton here in New Zealand. I'll put the long interview up with him up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, a pretty comprehensive interview. He is part of this, one of the spokespeople for the Groundswell, which is the farmers' protest against the policy that Jacinda and the government are trying to bring in of introducing a carbon market, carbon offset and a zero carbon policy. Now, which we all thought was something which was due to stop pollution of cars and things like that, but now apparently it's to stop farming cattle and things like that. But anyway, he talks here, Steve Cranston talks about the price per ton that New Zealand farmers are starting to have to consider when it comes to carbon.
So a lot of these companies, instead of reducing emissions themselves, it's cheaper just, we'll go buy a farm and plant trees. And that is sort of where we're at now in the New Zealand carbon market. And we've got a lot of other countries don't have this, but we're allowed to offset 100%. Companies can offset 100% of their emissions with carbon offsets. In a lot of other countries, it's only 10 or 20%. So that's why it's really just getting out of control here. And planting pine trees, with the way the carbon price is around $86, I think, per tonne at the moment, that just blows farming out of the water. It's probably 3 or 4 times more profitable now. So that's the risk. But there's a catch with that. And the carbon farming relies entirely on government policy to sustain itself. And if there's a change in government policy, those carbon farms may be unviable. So that is, it's a little bit of a house of cards. And there's a lot of pushback, and I can see a time when there will actually be a change in policy. And then what becomes of these carbon farms? Can they afford to pay the debt on a purchase they paid $60 million for? And I think this is going to be a big topic at the next election because, you know, producing food, that's part of the productive economy. That's genuine market-based production. Carbon farming, that's policy-based, a business model.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I tend to agree with that. I don't believe in carbon markets. It's a fantasy. The idea that we can set up a trading system where people can trade permits to pollute is a way, as the farmer there is pointing out, for the real polluters, you know, industry, to offset what they're doing by buying carbon credits and planting, trees on farms. And as he says, that's dependent upon the whole carbon market concept, which has been created by, you know, government dictates.
Yeah, and what's behind all this, of course, is this scientific analysis the government say is true. Steve is not quite so sure. His group, Groundswell, have been challenging the politicians to actually come up with any evidence that the science has got to back it.
Strongest, where the New Zealand farming community is really pushing back at the moment is just on the science. We're trying to get our politicians to actually acknowledge the science in the IPCC. So, and we've been asking politicians for evidence or data on what effect agriculture is actually having on climate, and none of them have any. So that's actually quite interesting. They're getting ahead of themselves with the policy, and they haven't actually done their homework on the actual warming effect of agriculture. And I think that's probably where they're the weakest, because this is science, this is what we can actually really prove, and prove that they got this wrong.
Well, it does seem like a very top-down effect. I mean, they're saying that the agriculture affects climate in an X, Y, Z fashion, and that they've got to do A, B, and C in order to correct it, but they absolutely don't have the science to back it up, the evidence to back it up, Martin. So this is why the farmers are saying, well, show us the evidence and we will do what you want. But until you do, we won't.
Well, I think the point you made first, to my mind, is stronger, which is we shouldn't have carbon markets. This is a delusion that this is exactly the...
There is something counterintuitive about the idea that a cow is, you know, obviously cows have been around being farmed for thousands of years, has had some sort of horrific effect on the climate, and it is going to cause, human race to become extinct, by its burps. It's often talked about cow farts, but actually cows apparently burp much more than they fart, according to Steve.
Well, let's unpack this logically, as I often say about this kind of topic. I don't agree with carbon markets because they're not real markets. That point was very well made. This is not a real market. It's only a
But do, Martin, answer the question I asked you, please, which is: are cows causing the world's climate to collapse and possibly destroy humanity and much of life on Earth?
I'm not a biologist. I'm an economist. I'm
so
trying
you think
to discuss
they are,
the.
Maybe?
I, no, I'm
think,
just saying, think, let's put it on one side and discuss
are.
The economics.
But do you think the cows perhaps are causing the climate to collapse and it can maybe make us extinct?
The real problem is, as if global warming is real, and obviously loads of people do believe it's so, that's why they're all in Egypt and all the rest of it, then it's the main culprits are fossil fuels. We know, and of course there may be some effect from agriculture, but only very intensive agriculture using large amounts of livestock. I mean, in many parts of the world, people, in India, people don't have loads of livestock. They're lucky if they've got a cow. Same in Poland. So it's not really an issue.
But
the way to solve it is not to have a pseudo market. You have to have a plan.
You've said that quite a few times. So one of the things Steve does talk about is the lobby groups for the various farmers. So there are various things. So, for example, the dairy farmers have a lobby group. The beef farmers have a lobby group. The sheep farmers have a lobby group. The arable farmers have a lobby group. Now, he's been saying that these lobby groups have, I'm putting words in his mouth here, apparently been infiltrated by the zero carbon lobby, and that they're not actually representing the farmers. So a lot of farmers in New Zealand are getting really rather annoyed that the groups that they're paying subscriptions to are going along with a lot of this. So they're leaving these groups, and that's in the longer interview, which will be up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk later. But then I also put to him this whole possibility that there may be, well, there already are beginnings of incentives for farmers to get, rather than diesel tractors, to get electric tractors.
That technology is nowhere close. You can have an electric motorbike, I believe, at this stage. I'm not sure how good they are. I haven't seen too many around. But no, there's generally no other options. And that's the other silly thing about a lot of these. They bought in we call it a ute tax, so SUV tax. So a lot of farmers and builders have a four-wheel drive utility vehicle to get around. So that now has a tax when you purchase it, and that money goes towards subsidising someone else to buy a hybrid or an electric vehicle. But what is that builder or farmer meant to do? There's no other options. So if they still want to be a builder or a farmer, they need a suitable vehicle. And that's where the policy's got ahead of the actual, what's even available. So you just got to pay the tax with no other option. So it doesn't change behaviour, it just costs more.
Well, just as a warning to people thinking of buying electric vehicles, check the guarantee on your battery of your vehicle. And also the replacement costs for the battery of your vehicle. I mean, you're talking about something like 15, in the UK money, £15,000 or New Zealand dollars, 30,000 New Zealand dollars to replace a battery. And some of the guarantees now are only 5 or 7 years.
Yeah, well, that's a big concern. The other one here in New Zealand is, where are all these batteries going to go? Like, it's a relatively new technology at the moment. Give it another 10 years where these a lot of these batteries are starting to fail. How are they disposed of? And we're also pretty much at the peak capacity of our electrical grid at the moment too. So yeah, once we start plugging all these cars in, what happens there? And I don't think anyone's really thinking that far ahead. I think the technology's there, but it's one of those things when it's good enough and everything's going to work, people will do it anyway. It's when you got government incentives sort of forcing everyone towards this stuff when the infrastructure and everything's not quite there or being thought through, that's when you get real adverse outcomes.
I mean, that's Steve Cranston there, dairy farmer, part of the Groundswell, well, one of the spokespeople for Groundswell, which is a group of protesters here. And then basically, Martin, they are threatening the government. They're saying, well, if you start really bringing this stuff in, then we're going to go to town. They've already had big protests in all the major cities where all the local farmers have been driving their tractors into parks and things like that. So they're not really getting in the way. They're just there to chat with members of the public in the city and make their voice heard. But they are certainly prepared to take things further if the government pursues these various options. But, I mean, it's quite clear that the... he's saying there, very, I think it makes an extremely good point that the they're being taxed for having these four-wheel drives, which obviously farmers need and builders need, people like that. But there's no other option. They've just got to have that. It's a tax, just a tax on farmers and builders, basically.
Well, the obvious solution that appears, you know, to me is that if you can show that you are a farmer or a builder and you have to have a four-wheel drive vehicle, and I accept that probably in certain circumstances you do need a four-wheel drive vehicle, especially if you're a farmer, then they shouldn't be taxed. But I can't see the case wearing four-wheel drive vehicles parked all over the pavements here in Bristol. There's no case for that at all, is there?
No, not necessarily. But, I mean, you know, that's not the point he's making, is it?
No.
I also asked him about something, the point that you made, I think, was last week, Martin, or maybe the week before, about fertilizer, because there is this nitrous oxide tax that they want to bring in, or they're beginning to implement here. I mean, he's basically saying all these things are interventions which are really seriously affecting the profitability of farms, pushing farmers out of business. And now, isn't it handy? There's all these private equity firms, including, of course, the likes of Bill Gates, people like that, to want to buy up all this land and plant trees on it for carbon offset. And of course, that gives them ownership of that land, and the land can no longer be afforded by farmers. So farming is under assault here. And he explains that fertilizer for the arable farmers mainly is part of that.
So arable farmers, anyone who puts fertilizer on will have a small amount of nitrous oxide. And like I say, it's about 18-19% of a typical sheep and beef or dairy farm as well. So, it is part of the mix.
Okay, so this new policy being brought in here, is it going to affect exports?
Oh, definitely. Well, they're looking at reducing our sheep and beef production by around 20% and dairy by 6%. So I forget the exact numbers off the top of my head, but that's a couple of billion dollars of lost exports for New Zealand, and the flow-on effect from that in rural communities is just amplifies it. So it's going to have a major effect on our rural economy over time. But, you know, I guess good for other countries. If we're that silly to shoot ourselves in the foot like this, other countries are going to benefit.
Well, I must say I really warmed to Steve meeting him over at his little place. I mean, it was a town called Eureka, which didn't really seem to have anything in it. I mean, it was I think there was a school there, but as I drove past, there was nobody around. It was just a crossroads, really. But anyway, that's near Hamilton in New Zealand. And, he's part of this organisation called Groundswell, which is organising the farmers because the industry bodies apparently are not doing their job. One would say, obviously, the parallel to draw is with the National Farmers Union in the UK, which seems to be just a part of the establishment, really, and something that the farmers are part of because it gives them cheap insurance, but it's not actually lobbying in their interest. So, I mean, it does seem, Martin, that the exports of New Zealand are affected by this as well. The government doesn't really seem to care anymore about whether or not it can earn foreign currency, does it?
Well, obviously, if they get this wrong, there's going to be downsides and bad effects. I'm not familiar completely with what goes on in the New Zealand farming sector, although I do have some knowledge of it.
You've got a lot of knowledge of it. Well, yeah. We've worked through Shelley, haven't
you? Yeah. The New Zealand farmers have been major exporters for years. But, of course, because of Brexit here in this country, one of the things that may happen if deals are done is that our farmers will be put out of business by the New Zealand farmers. And that's perfectly logical because our farmers are inefficient, far more inefficient than New Zealand farmers. Now, ultimately, of course, every country wants to have some kind of farming industry, including Britain, where it's not really viable. But that means that New Zealand, therefore, is going to, over time, is going to lose markets where other people subsidise their agricultural production. One of the problems they've got is that, especially for dairy farmers, is that one of the big markets for New Zealand agricultural products is China. And in China, in actual fact, lots of people don't use dairy products. It's not part of the general cultural mix, and some people haven't got lactose tolerance, so they can't eat it.
And that sounds horrendous. I'm not going to go and live in China if there's no cheese.
Well, anyway, they do have cheese, but there's just not, lots of people don't eat it because it makes them feel ill, you know.
Well, cheese on toast. I'm sure that
because some people have got lactose intolerance, Tony, because of the genetics. They can't use dairy products.
Chinese people don't. Okay. Anyway, interesting. Didn't know about that. You're full of information. Anyway, so that was, as I said, Steve Cranston. The full interview with him, discussing all aspects of his farm and generally this whole policy of zero carbon being applied to farming in New Zealand, much like it's been in Holland. Will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. On now to Joan Brooks. Now, she's a Coromandel resident who came to New Zealand aged 6 years old. I thought I'd ask her a bit about what it was like when she was a young girl living in the Coromandel, because it's it was a big forested and hilly, mountainous even area. Where actually most of the communications was around the coast by ships, and there wasn't anything much, certainly no railways, but not much in the way of roads, and the roads were really only put in. And this is one thing I find amazing about New Zealand, Martin, and maybe you could got something to say about this, about the general colonisation. You'll find that much of the exploitation by the empire of the New Zealand's natural resources after, you know, they put down the Maori and the Moriori, but who, by the way, were around before the Maori, who the Maori put down, much of this was photographed. You know, so for example, you know, you've got all your foresters chopping down all the trees, the farmers, etc. The towns almost, you know, being built at the time of the railways in the 1800s, late 1800s, and roads around the Coromandel only actually being finished in the 1960s. So it's a very, very recent bit of colonisation, Martin.
Well, I mean, New Zealand is a relatively underpopulated place and it's quite big. So, you know, if you go to the Highlands of Scotland, you don't see that many people and hardly any roads, you know.
No, you know what? I do think you're right, actually. You know, Scotland's got a lot of similarities with New Zealand. Anyway, let's have a listen to Joan Brooks about her early days here in New Zealand, age six when she first came here in the 1950s.
I was in a little village called Aspligais. It was in Bedfordshire. And I don't think most children look upon a new country as a new experience. I think most of them do. They don't start worrying about wanting to be at home, not like the mothers did. Mm. A lot of the women who came out missed their family and they wanted to go home. Children don't. They look upon every new experience as something new and something different.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people have been encouraged to come to New Zealand from England over the years. What was it that brought your parents out here?
Well, my father said the climate was to start with. But he was insurance and in Britain. And when he came out here, he trained to be a primary teacher.
So, do you go back to the UK now? What do you, you know?
Oh,
what
yes, I've been back two or three times. I've been back to where I live. I've seen the house. I had to see the bluebells, but I got the feeling that every single inch of the land has been walked over. And when I came back here, I drove down through Wongamomina, and I looked into the bush, and I thought, there are areas in that bush that nobody has ever trod on.
Yes, it's a much more, and I see sometimes these gravel roads are going out into, well, out into the bush, really. There are still people sort of buying sections and building completely fresh places, aren't there?
Yes, there are. And the Coromandel, when we first came here in the 60s, and we had a little batch down below, and it was a beautiful place. There were, in fact, Paku was covered in sheep. You wouldn't think it to look at it now. There were two buildings in on the main centre. One was a local store, and there was a petrol station. Everything you needed, you had to bring. And we came down here weekend after weekend with our two children and loved it.
So you say a batch. So that the idea is that you were living in a city somewhere or in a town somewhere, yes, and teaching there, and it was a sort of little holiday home.
Yes,
but I mean, that's a tradition over here, isn't it? Quite a lot of, actually, the Russians do something very similar with their dachas. You know, they have a little place in the country. The French do the same sort of thing too.
Well, I think more and more people, they don't want a batch. They want a house, and they want a mansion away from their mansions in the city. I mean, we lived on the shore in the city, and our little batch had no power. It had no running water. It had a long drop. Our shower was a kerosene can with a burette clip on it, and that's how we lived. And we came down for a break. We used to go out fishing. We'd just go out to shoe, catch our dinner. We could free dive out to slipper, 15 feet of water, we could get scallops. Nowadays, you can't even catch fish if you go out to the Alderman.
Why is that? I mean, is this regulations trying to stop people fishing, that sort of thing, bureaucracy?
Too many people. Mm-hmm. Too many people around, too many boats.
Joan Brooks there giving an idea of, not the 50s, sorry, it was the 1960s she came out here. But then she's also talked to me a bit about politics and the way that there is a sort of special kind of pro-government, certainly I suppose you could say a little bit like the ones who are prepared to go along with a lot of bureaucracy, Maori, who are being used to sort of almost like be the, they are the representatives of the Maori, or even though a lot of the Maori don't agree with the various organisations they're being co-opted into. So let's have a listen now to her talk about Maori and the Moriori, who were around before the Maori were.
I read a book written by a man, young man in England who joined the Navy to come out to Australia to do sealing. And John lent me this book, and I found it very interesting. But while he was sealing and whaling, they came from Australia and they came to New Zealand, and they also caught seals and whales. Now, he said at one stage that the Maoris used to invade a tribe, and they used to take the nine-year-olds, and the chief used to tie them behind their canoe and tow them till they drowned. Now,
well, that sounds like the sort of crime that the Royal Navy might have been up to back in the day.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
the British Empire wasn't sort of soft touch, was it?
Yes, that's true. And all around this area, there are fortune tellers, whether you believe what they say, but there are fortune tellers who come here and say, this place is not nice, the background is not nice. And they found so many skulls. A slipper was apparently a prison island, and they used to send their prisoners out there. I heard they cut their tendons so that they couldn't escape, and they were meat on the hoof. The Maoris were known for their violence. The Morioris were peaceful. Now, on this...
Well, I think if you look at the All Blacks and the Haka, you can see that they're quite... That could be,
I don't like rugby anyway.
Well, okay. But it certainly doesn't look as if it's a peaceful religion, does it?
No, it doesn't.
But the thing is that I think with the empire, there was this sort of soft touch of sending in the clerics and the priests. Mm-hmm. And then once the indigenous population had been softened up, that's when the trouble started, because people would be infiltrated in. And the British were, you know, pretty ruthless too. They were all after land. They've always been fighting after land.
They were, but a lot of the Maoris signed the Treaty of Waitangi in order to prevent themselves from being wiped out.
Okay. Can you say something about this treaty?
Now, I've only believed what I've read over years and years and years. Half the Maoris supported the treaty, and they wanted the protection from Queen Victoria. The other half were against the treaty, and they turned on the Maoris that signed the treaty.
Well, isn't that interesting? That sounds like a British divide-and-rule tactic. We've done this in many places. I say we, you know, our predecessors.
Well...
So the Maori were at each other over the treaty?
They were at each other over the treaty, but the Moriores were very peaceful people. Now, I had read that a tribe that was being pursued fled to the South Island, and they fled to the Chathams, I think it was, where the Morioris lived, and they were nursed back to health by the Morioris. When they were healthy, they repaid the Morioris by killing them all. Now, this is the way the Maoris work. I have lived next to a Maori who was a fine man. We have some fine examples of Maori in our community. But a lot of the people at the top are more English, they're more Irish, they're more Welsh, and it's as if their little bit of Maori blood, be a 16th or even a 32nd, is the only thing that matters. Their English blood doesn't matter, their Irish blood doesn't matter, their Scottish blood doesn't matter. And ACT Party, and I've never been a supporter of ACT, but they have a Maori woman in their party, and she married somebody from Borneo, I think. He was a political refugee. And so her children are half Borneo and half Maori. And she said she has been accused of being a born-again Maori. She has been accused of being stupid and told to go back and get her Maori roots. And she said her children count for nothing unless they say they're Maori. They are supposed to completely forget their Borneo side. Now, that is not right.
But it is difficult, isn't it, these days for people to get a kind of settled culture. But look, I mean, this is something which has come to the fore, hasn't it, with the Labour Party and particularly with Jacinda. And it's difficult for anyone to criticise Jacinda because she, a couple of years ago, was voted back in, wasn't she, you know, with quite a big majority. So somebody in New Zealand must like, in fact, the majority of people in New Zealand, as you've got a proportional representation system, must be supporting what she's doing. So do you want to just say something about her and then about what she's doing about Indigenous rights here?
Well, she was only elected to power because Winston Peters, who was the kingmaker at the time, refused to work with National. He would only work with Labour. Labour were in disarray. She came from nowhere. She hadn't even held a ministerial post, and she was the leader, and so she got in. That government was absolutely disastrous. The National Party then went through a period of disarray. Bill English, who was a very good man, resigned. John Key resigned, and they had a series of leaders that they didn't like, and so she got voted back in again. But she will not get voted in 2023. I guarantee it. Because although her popularity is dropping rapidly, and she is still the most popular Prime Minister, the Labour Party has gone down and down and down and down, and now there's no hope.
Right, so that's a final clip from Joan Brooks talking about a bit about history here and New Zealand politics. It does sound as if there's just an attempt to sort of divide and rule again, you know, but maybe Jacinda is guilty this time, trying to set the population, the white and the Maori population, against each other, Martin.
Well, she may be right that Jacinda will lose the next election. We'll have to see, won't we? It's a projection. She definitely won the last one. because the National Party under Crusher Clark, as she was called, because she wanted to crush the cars of juvenile delinquents, even though most juvenile delinquents who stole cars didn't have any cars. And they made a big deal about how the lockdown had failed and all the rest of it, which really didn't go down at all well. Now, coming back to the history of the New Zealand Labour Party, Winston Peters, after they got PR through, Winston Peters' party, was a Maori party, because Winston Peters was a Maori, he initially aligned with National, so that the National Party, with Winston Peters' support, were the main beneficiaries at the beginning of the PR process. But when he changed sides, of course, that then started to tip things in the other direction. The thing about the PR system in New Zealand is, in fact, change can happen. You know, new parties can be formed, New Zealand First, okay, for example.
Okay. Just looking at the popularity of Jacinda, there's been a sharp drop, we hear this week, in support for Ardern and Labour. The News Hub Reed Research has Labour at just over 32%, down nearly 6 points since April, more than 7 points behind the Nationals, mm-hmm. who are their sort of Tory party, up slightly to 40%. And it's the lowest result that Labour have had since Ardern took over. I mean, she's got to do something to scrabble back her popularity here. And one of the things I saw in the paper this week was that she's making a lot of criticism of the bank profits. But the trouble is, what are the government actually going to do about it? I mean, and can the New Zealand government really intervene and legislate to stop the banks making profits?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? Even if you raise that as an issue, can you actually carry through on it? But even if the National Party are on 40% there, now under a proportional system, that's not enough to form a government. So they'll have to find alliance partners unless they get over 50%. And now they may be able to find them. They may be able to find them, or they may not.
It's a bit like Bristol, where the Labour and the Greens over here are kind of in some sort of alliance. Anyway, we'll finish off tonight. We can say goodbye to you now, Martin, because I've no doubt you won't have anything particular to say about this. Thank you ever so much for all your contributions this week. Our final piece this week is with the New Zealand preacher, bless him, Barry Smith. And if anyone's never come across Barry, I mean, a lot of people have said over here that I've been chatting with, oh, Barry Smith had it all sorted out like 20 years ago. He knew what was going to happen. So let's have a listen to Barry Smith as our final clip, where he talks about the occult and evil people at the end of the world.
In the last days, there will be three evil beings running the world system, and they are called by three titles. I'll put them on the overhead for you. There they are. These three beings. First of all, we have that evil-looking one in the middle there, Satan, taking the place of God the Father. There will be a man running the common market. His name is called Antichrist, and he'll be your political man. And then we'll have a man called the False Prophet, and he will be running the world church. So you'll have three of them, a satanic trinity, in these days. Now, the Word of God teaches us that there is a powerful spirit in the world today who is opening the way for them to come to power. Let's read together, shall we, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 6. All the King James readers, read with me. And now you know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way. The question is, what is stopping the mystery of iniquity from being revealed? First of all, what is the meaning of the mystery of iniquity? In the Word of God, it says in the Amplified Bible, the mystery of iniquity, or that hidden principle of rebellion against all constituted authority, is already at work in the world today. And you will know that that spirit is being fostered by certain people who bring in laws in the education system, like taking the cane out of schools, for example. You see, if you sow the wind, you will reap the whirlwind. And as I said the other night, a strap or a cane will do the job that 5,000 psychiatrists cannot do. When I was teaching down here at Beresford Street School, we had a special class, and I used to teach another class of people from the Pacific Islands. 89% of my kids were Pacific Island kids, and they didn't speak English very well. My job was to teach them. The special class had people with learning disabilities and so on, and some of them were really strange children. Whenever the teacher of that class had any problems, she'd bring them over to me, and I would take from my bag a very special friend, shall you? And with this friend of mine, I would assist their learning process. There it is. And I found that pretty well everybody became normal once receiving a bit of that. Very surprising. There's no talk needed. The children feel better when they have something like that because it is recommended in the Word of God. In the book of Proverbs, if you don't read it, the wisest man in the world's name was Solomon. Chapter 22 and verse 15, Proverbs, he said these words. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now the funny thing about the policy that the government is bringing in at the moment is as follows. They take away the strap where you would whack children on the bottom or the hand, but they leave the police armed with long batons to wrap them over the skull later on. And I say it would be better to whack them on the bottom with a soft strap rather than a club over the head later and break their skulls. Very inconsistent. Now let's move on, shall we? We notice then that these three beings are going to come to power, but there is something stopping them, and the question is, what is stopping the rise of the mystery of iniquity? Some people tell me that the Christians, who are known as the Bride of Christ, are that force which is stopping the Antichrist from being revealed. They say that once Jesus comes back for his bride, the Christians, the bride goes up, and then all evil breaks loose on the earth. Well, I do admit that the bride is a very powerful stabilizing force, and I say, thank God for every born-again believer. That's great. One morning we were crossing the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and the family were all with me, and as we went across it, some of you know Sydney Harbour Bridge. It's just the traffic is just flat out all the time. Two speeds, flat out and stop. And we were going over on a Sunday morning. Everything was very quiet on Sunday morning. I said to the family, do you know why everything's quiet on Sunday morning? They said, no, Dad. I said, all the devils are in bed sleeping off Saturday night. That's true, you know. Everything's very quiet Sunday morning. Have you ever noticed when you come to church? All the devils are in bed, you see. Champagne at night, real pain in the morning. Now. And so we notice then that the Bride of Christ is a very powerful stabilizing force in the world today. When the Christians are gone, it will take away the salt of the earth. Everything will go rotten. That is true, but we are not the restraining force. Some people tell me that it is the Holy Spirit that is the restraining force. They teach us that when the Lord Jesus Christ comes, and I teach before the 3.5 years of tribulation, they say that the Holy Spirit will also go up with Jesus. I do not agree with that, and the reason is that people are going to be converted during the tribulation period. In the book of Revelation chapter 7, it says these words, that a number of people dressed in white robes will get up to heaven, and one will say, what are these that are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? Which in simple English means, who are these people with white robes on? Where do they come from? And the answer is given, these are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. In other words, there are going to be people saved during the tribulation. If you have loved ones who do not get saved in these meetings, as long as they come to the meeting, that's the main thing. And when it all happens, they will never forget what they heard in these meetings, and they can still get saved during the tribulation. The only difficult portion is this. They will get to heaven, but they will go minus their heads. Now we read the next bit. We notice that there is something else which is restraining, and that is Antichrist himself. Reading the writings of Dr. Ivan Pannon of Bible Numerics fame, he says these words. He says, if you read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 6, you will find the meaning of verse 7. Let's read it again, shall we? Here we go. And now you know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. If you look that up in the Amplified Bible, it says, in his own appointed time. In other words, the Antichrist is alive on earth tonight. He is a Jewish man. We have established that. He is so in touch with Lucifer or Satan that they actually have a chain of communication. They talk to each other. I don't know if you people in New Zealand here know this, that in New Zealand we have a group called a Church of Satan. Did you know that certain people actually talk to Satan? Did you know there is a woman written a book who actually married Satan? They walked into the fire together, both of them, and they weren't burned. Satan and this human woman walked into a fire together. Did you know in certain parts of New Zealand and Australia up past the Gold Coast, they take human fetuses of babies and use them in a communion service? Some people are not aware of these things. They think it's some sort of a joke. It's not a joke. Satan is a real being. He's an enemy of God, and we are here tonight to blow his cover and to show you that Jesus Christ is greater than all the power of the enemy. 1 John chapter 4, verse 4, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. So anybody tonight is into Satanism, you better get out of it as fast as you can. And that applies to witches as well, some of you here tonight. Now, over here you see Antichrist himself is setting himself up, and when the stage is just right, he will reveal himself as to who he is. He will be the world leader and will run the common market and set up a peace treaty in the Middle East. Now, did you know that over every country in the world there is a spirit? There is a spirit over New Zealand, and the name of the spirit over New Zealand is indifference. There is a spirit running Australia, his twin brother, indifference. New Zealand's motto, she will be right. Australia's motto, she will be right, mate. But of course it's not all right. It's bad, actually. Some of you will know that this seal is on the back of the American dollar bill. It is the seal of the Illuminati, or the world government people, the seal of Lucifer himself, and that eye inside the triangle up there is actually the eye of Lucifer. I remember when we were in Nazareth in 1986, we went to the place where Jesus was brought up as a boy. Going down the steps of this great Roman Catholic church, we saw that eye inside a triangle on the wall of a church. Right above the spot where you go down to have a look at Jesus' boyhood home, where Joseph and Mary brought him up in Nazareth. And my friend who was with me said, look at that. And I said, I'll ask the guide what it is. I said to this Arab guide, what's that on the wall? He said, that is the eye of God, sir. I said, is it? I said, you're an Arab, aren't you? He said, yes. I said, why don't you tell us the truth? That's not the eye of God, that's the eye of Horus in Egyptian mythology, and you know perfectly well it's the eye of Lucifer. Do you know what he said? He said, quite right, sir. Well, I said, why do you tell the tourists lies like that? He said, because we don't want to upset the tourists. How's that? In a religious building right above the spot where Jesus was brought up as a boy, there is the eye of Lucifer. Now listen, if you see that eye, or even the five-pointed star, or the six-pointed star, the hexagram, the pentagram, whatever, if you see them in a triangle or in a circle, that is witchcraft. If you see them outside of that, it's nothing too much to worry about. Mainly inside the circle and mainly inside the triangle, that will tell you definitely that that is witchcraft. Many other times as well, of course, even outside of the circle.
The late, great Barry Smith. I think he died in the UK, actually. All sorts of fascinating stuff. He did some books as well. But his family hasn't really carried on his tradition, as often happens. So if you're interested in tracking down, I'll see if I can dig out something else from Barry next week. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. The podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses, that you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You'll find me on vk.com as well as Facebook. And I'll put those various interviews up, particularly the ones with the New Zealanders and also with Don DeBar, up on our show page later. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over on Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqk.com. So we've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft with me over here, that is also at the BCFM Politics Show app and at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey. The app you can get from the Apple Store or all good app stores, not necessarily Google. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own many of the transmitters and the printing presses. That is the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us, but not the BCFM Politics Show, on talkradio.org.uk, the live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Fluke.
Stop the world.